I'd like to welcome everybody out to the RAC meeting tonight. For those of you that haven't been to a RAC meeting before, the procedure is the division will do a presentation on their recommendation. It'll be opened up to questions from the RAC, then questions from the audience, and I remind everybody to keep it to questions, and hopefully the questions will be for clarification purposes so that they understand the recommendation. At that point, when there's no more questions, we'll open it up to discussion and recommendations from the public. And that's the time that you can stand on your soapbox and give your opinion. And then after the comments from the audience, we'll close it to the audience and open it up to discussion and hopefully a motion from the RAC to pass or reject or tweak whatever way they want to. But we need to take something forward to the board on each one of these agenda items with an action next to them. Does anybody have any changes or additions to the minutes from last time? If not, could I get a motion to accept the minutes and the agenda? Pam made a motion to accept the minutes as present. And the agenda?
I guess, yeah.
Sure. That's great. Second by Kevin Albrick. Any discussion? All in favor? Opposed? Unanimous? Regional update. Bill, do you have?
Sure. Is the regional update on there yet? Well, let's wait till.
I can do it. Yeah. I'm going to be doing the board update, I guess, from now on. Evidently, there was some concern from the AG's office of having a wildlife board member do the update. I don't know exactly why, but he advised strongly to not involve a board member on the update. So, figure out where we are here. On the
come here. What was on that list you had around?
This is all the presentations.
Oh, well,
what's that?
The Southern Region requested a well, I won't say the Southern Region. The board talked about a fifth tier of a buck-doe ratio on four units in the Southern Region, and it failed 2-4 and 4 against that motion. Another issue that came up in the discussion on that was, if you guys remember, any permits that don't get sold for the permit for the weapon type would roll over into another weapon type. And all the RACs seem to feel like they just soon see the permits not go sold as to roll them over into the next. But due to a lack of motion from the board, nothing happened on that. So it passed with the rest of the division recommendation as far as the permits will roll over into the next season type. Whatever isn't sold will roll over. Is that was right, wasn't it?
Yeah, let me just clarify a little bit. The Southern Region RAC passed a motion to not allow the permits to roll over, but all the other four RACs did not make that motion or, you know, make that recommendation. And Darris is to be excused on part of this stuff because he was stuck in traffic and a couple hours late to the meeting, and I had to sit in his RAC chair, so the notes are probably a little bleak.
Motion or the Southeastern Region RAC took forward the proposal to make the San Juan 18-25 buck-doe ratio. There was a lot of discussion and concern about the San Juan buck-doe ratio being different than the La Salle buck-doe ratio. If one was higher than the other, a lot of those permits for the higher buck-doe ratio unit would probably end up to Wasatch Front people. This, if their San Juan and La Salle are the same, then it kind of spreads the Wasatch Front people out a little more and gives the locals a little more opportunity to hunt their unit. After that discussion, from lack of a motion from the board, it stayed at the division recommendation, which was 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does. Northeast Region voted to have all their units go to the 18 to 20, and that died from lack of a motion as well, so it stayed with the Northeast Region units stayed with the division recommendation. Ernie requested that the RACs, on all our votes, whatever the minority is, I guess, which is usually the opposed votes, he said it helps him for some kind of a statement in the minutes of why they voted against it. I don't know if that's going to be a requirement or not, but if anybody who does vote no after each vote, I'm just going to open it up for anybody that wants to get in the record of why they voted no, and if you want to, great. If you don't,
that can't become required, can it? There's no way that can become required. If we're talking, that's crazy.
It's not part of the.
Yeah.
The rules.
Who shouldn't have to do that?
Hey, it's one of the Wildlife Board members, Ernie Perkins. He's one of the Northern Region Wildlife Board members. He said it just helps him understand the argument, you know, and if, you know, which way he's leaning towards, you know, or could be convinced if he knows why they're voting against it.
I think if we felt strongly enough about it, we could communicate with the board why we voted no. I did that. This board meeting on the elk vote, the Manti bulls that we, the number of permits there.
Right.
So I mean, I don't feel like we should have to.
Yeah, and I'm not gonna, you know, sit here and stare at you till you say something. So but I am gonna give everybody an opportunity after a vote.
Yeah,
if somebody wants an opportunity to explain their reasoning,
there may be some issues where we feel, you know, and I probably should have done that, you know, when I voted no on the. Number of permits because we'll get to that later.
Okay. My notes are so I can't even read them. If I'm skipping over something, Bill, that you. A lot of stuff in other regions.
That's probably the only thing you missed was just the deer management plan is accepted unanimously.
The remainder of the deer proclamation, there was very little change to the division recommendation at the end of a couple hours of talking about.
Although it's important to know that they discussed every issue. It was actually a long discussion, but at the end they just approved it as presented.
A lot of the discussion on it was they were getting pulled in totally opposite directions, so they felt that. If everybody was pulling them the opposite direction, they felt they were in the middle where they should be is kind of their reasoning on it.
And the other thing they expressed is that we don't have any data yet. We've never had a season under this scenario, so to try to tweak things right now, they just felt was premature. And, you know, John Barron and Mike King both in particular made mention that they'll feel a lot more comfortable tweaking things in the future if there's a need, if the data shows there's a need.
So when you say they failed to make a motion, they just didn't feel like, I guess I don't understand that part. They just let it go as the DWR, as the division presented it. Is that what you mean?
Right. Every time we voted something different as a RAC from what the division recommended, they take each individual thing that's different and they discuss it, and then if there's enough interest in it or they think it's a good idea, if one of them thinks it's a good idea, they'll make a motion to accept whatever that recommendation was or tweak it a little bit different and try to incorporate what the RACs wanted, and then it takes a second to carry it to a vote. And most of them, there was no motion at all. Some of them, I think there's one that had a motion, but no second. So, and unless there's a second, they can't even vote on it as
a board. So automatically, just what the division proposes, what goes into effect, basically.
Right. Whatever. If anything they don't change, the remainder stays in effect as a division.
Well, at least when they made that motion to accept the, you know, the presentation.
So I'm a little, I guess I'm kind of confused here on the process. To me, that sounds broken. So we've all come now, traveled a long ways, spent a lot of time, effort to study issues and vote on an issue, such as the deer on the Manti and the San Juan. And that doesn't even come up for a vote?
Oh, it did come up for a vote.
Well, didn't come for a vote because no one made a motion to vote on that.
But it was discussed. They talked about for probably 15, 20 minutes about just the San Juan and LaSalle.
I spent a couple of hours last night listening to the minutes of the meeting. And brutal, but I did it anyway. It just makes no sense to me that we voted on that 8-1. That's not split down the middle. That wasn't like the southern region where it was 7-6 and the chairman had to break the tie. That was 8-1, and that can't even come up for a vote. I mean, to me, there was a proposal you're talking about where they wanted to create the extra tier in the southern region, the 20-25, and the wildlife board member that represents that region says, I feel the need to make this motion. He was kind of resigned to the fact I took that it wasn't going to pass, and he knew it wasn't going to pass, and maybe he didn't even agree with it. But he at least made the motion, and he got a second, and then it got voted down. I guess I'm not upset that we didn't get 18-20 on the Manti or the San Juan. The point to me is we didn't even get a vote on. I mean, we didn't even get it to a vote, and to me that says this is kind of a broken process. I don't understand why we're here making motions and voting 8-1 and not to get it on a vote at the board. That makes not a lot of sense to me.
The only thing I can offer, and maybe Darius would rather talk to this, but is just the comment that they were uncomfortable making a change before there was ever even a
well,
season.
Well, yeah, but so was I. But we
passed it. We made the change by the division bringing it back to us because we voted a year ago to make it 18-25.
Yeah.
And so I think that's argument's kind of invalid because we already changed it before we did anything with it. We didn't
that's
even try it at 18-25. So
I too listen to the minutes, and the question I have is where did the confusion on the San Juan and the comments on the San Juan come from?
What do you mean by confusion?
I heard the discussion, but where did the comments that were brought up by the public, because we never heard one comment on that the public did not want those units split or meeting. In fact, we only had two people that were opposed, that wanted 15 to 17. Everyone else at the meeting wanted 18 to 20. And yet now all of a sudden this comes up. I'm just wondering where that come up.
Evidently, they get hundreds of emails on lots of issues. I know they get a lot of input besides just from RAC, but they get phone calls and they get emails, and I assume that's where the pulling opposite directions is coming from.
So in the comments, you brought it up. Was it you that received the phone calls, or was it the board?
It was the board.
I
received two phone calls on one was from the committee chair for SFW down there, Ecker, Terry Ecker, I think it's Terry, and then one from one other person, I think, I can't remember for sure, but they were pretty passionate that, you know, they were more concerned instead of with the buck-doe ratio is that whatever they did, they kept them the same.
That's why I
just brought that up so that they could hash it and at least have that discussion at the board meeting.
Like Todd, that really upsets me the most is not one way or the other that the vote way it went, but that a couple phone calls and people don't have the time to come to the meeting that can represent the public at the RAC can sway a vote. When each one of us at the RAC takes so much time to go through those emails, I know they were in the hundreds, and yet someone that couldn't take the time to come to the RAC can, right before the board meeting, make a few phone calls and have such weight. I guess I'm wondering about
that,
the process.
That to me says process is broken. If that kind of influence, because they need to come to the RAC, that's what the RAC set up for, if I'm not mistaken, is to allow the public time to... So if in between the RAC and the board meeting, they need to address those to the board, not the RAC chairman that's going to go and present before the board.
I guess I'd add one other thing, too. There was another part of the discussion was that Justin Shannon and Guy Wallace met with, you know, representatives of sportsmen in both Moab and San Juan County before the meeting, and they were united in wanting to keep those two units managed the same. And that, so we did carry that comment forward.
See, Travis, when he was at the RAC, he refuted that and said that, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case. So, are there minutes to these meetings? Or, I mean, who was invited? You know, who was there? I mean, to me, that's, if I'm sending out the invitations, so I pretty much know who's, you know, what to expect back.
Even though, you know, one thing I'd like everybody to know is that the comments you made tonight have been very good, and there's somebody here that I'm sure has heard every word, and even though he anymore can't come up and talk about it.
We able to ask Mr. King questions about things at the board now, or is that off limits too? What's the...
We can certainly ask if he feels comfortable answering. That'd be up to him, but I don't see a problem asking.
I'd be happy to answer questions the way that I understand things.
Okay. I'm just wondering, I guess, to me, you're the Southeastern representative or on the board. When we pass something 8-1, to me that's a pretty good indication that maybe that should at least be made a motion. And like I said, the Southern representative made that motion, even though he maybe didn't agree or felt that was defeated, but he kind of respected our vote. And I just wondering why you didn't make that motion.
Well, I don't think that... And someone can correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe I need some education, but I don't represent the Southeast part of the state. I'm a representative from the Southeast, but I'm a state wildlife board member. So I think my constituency is the whole state.
That's appropriate.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. So... that puts me in a pretty interesting position. And I unfortunately was not able to attend the meeting, the RAC meeting, prior to the board meeting. However, I did listen to all of it, and I read the minutes as well. And my personal opinion when it came to the deer situation was that it was a pretty complex issue, and that there were a lot of factors that needed to be considered before making that type of a decision. You've talked about a few of them already. You talked about the interest in managing the LaSalle's and the San Juan unit at the same buck-to-doe ratios. That was something that came up. The board got literally hundreds of emails before the board meeting, and some of them were from RAC members, and some of them were from people that had been to the meeting here, that RAC meeting. And there were letters from literally hundreds of people. The majority of the letters that I read were not in favor of that higher buck-to-doe ratio. Most of them were for more opportunity. And that wasn't just for the southeast unit, that was statewide. Other issues that came up in the discussion were the fact that they found a new case of CWD in the San Juan unit this year. And that's something that has to be looked at. And generally speaking, in those units that have CWD, they manage for a lower buck-to-doe ratio in an effort to keep older deer at a lower level, because the older deer seem to be more susceptible to the CWD. That's why, one of the reasons why the LaSalle's are at that level. So those kind of things come up. The board is charged to look at these issues from a statewide basis, and the charge is to look at them from a variety of perspectives. Obviously, the most important of those is managing the wildlife resource and making sure that it's sustainable and we have those resources around in perpetuity. But then you have all these other complicating factors that come in. You obviously have to, we rely on the division as the fact-finding body to present us with things with the biological basis, the scientific basis. And that's very important to us. Obviously, the science behind these decisions is important, and we hope that all of the recommendations have that good scientific base. Another thing that's important, obviously, is the desires and needs and wants of the sportsmen, the hunting and fishing groups, and others that just want to watch wildlife. Then there's another aspect of that, and that's the economic aspect. And I'm not talking about the division losing funds if they cut back the number of permits. I'm talking about the local economic impact that wildlife have on a particular area. You eliminate 1,700 permits from southeastern Utah, that has the potential to have a huge economic impact. So there are all those kind of things that factor into the decision. And personally, I didn't feel comfortable with the elimination of that many permits based on the economic issues, based on the loss of opportunity issues, based on the potential looking at what might happen with CWD in the future, plus, again, the fact that this is a new program. We're just starting out. We don't have any data, really, to base decisions on, and so that's kind of where I was coming from. I don't know that I need to say any more than that. That's maybe more than I should have said already, but that's where I was coming from. If I would have made a motion I can't speak for anyone else. I wouldn't be surprised as if happened with the other motion that it wouldn't have got a second or it wouldn't have been able to come to a vote. But I personally didn't feel like that I was in a position to make a motion for that to come forward. So.
One question. I know when in preparing to come to the RAC meeting, you know, you do your best in reading the notes, and sometimes you get emails or phone calls. But I know that in coming to the meeting, I don't know what my decision is going to be, and many times it has changed when I go through the process, hear the DWR's proposal, go through that, am able to ask questions. So I can appreciate that, you know, through that process. I know you guys had a Wednesday meeting and a lot of material presented there. So I can appreciate that there's a lot of stuff that goes on to make that decision. But I, at the same time, I'm wondering what weight does the RAC and that vote have in preparing for that decision on a certain region that comes, you know, as a state representative, it may not just, I'm not just saying Southeastern, but say if the Southern RAC votes one way, what weight does that have in that process?
Well, it's hard to say. I know that all of the board members take those things very seriously. It's important to them and us and to me to hear what the RACs are thinking. That's obviously a very important factor. But, you know, beyond that, I can't give you a weight. And really, we were deciding Thursday during the meeting individually how to vote. And we didn't make up our minds on Wednesday what was going to happen. And you're being pulled many different directions, and it's hard to make a decision. You know, you're going to make folks upset regardless of the decision. So that's it's always a challenge.
Well, we'll find out from now on if this is something we can do or not. Well, sure, we'll. There will be those that read the minutes and let us know.
Anybody have any other questions for Mike while he's here?
I know it's hard to feel appreciated when the things that you recommend don't get voted on. They certainly were considered, though, and I think pretty thoughtfully by all of the board members. And I'm happy to talk with you any time before those meetings, and I did get a chance to talk with a couple of you just the day before the meeting. And being relatively new on the board, I still don't have relationships with a lot of you. So any time that you'd like to get in touch with me and talk about something, I'm happy to do that. So please feel free to get in touch with me, and I'll try to get in touch with you as well when we have questions.
Thanks, Mike. On the Manti, our recommendation was 360 bull permits. Central region, evidently they wanted more. I don't have the number they wanted. But anyway, they kind of split the difference.
They did. They wanted about 440, I think. 456. Okay. Well, 482 is the recommendation, but 456 is what the central region recommended.
Yeah. So the Wildlife Board just kind of split the difference between the two. We ended up with 406 tags on the Manti. They reduced book cliffs, limited entry tags. Is that right?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
It's like 150, I think. Kevin, do you remember how many they reduced book cliffs by? Was
it?
Yeah. Down to 130 is what it was.
Our recommendation was 150. There was a proposal from one of the sportsman groups for 110. The Northeastern RAC settled on 130 as a board. I went with what the RAC had recommended.
And they also reduced the Dutton?
The beaver, and that was a big discussion, was the beaver with, you know, they had a landowner that shot five bulls or something in his haystack, and the board kind of, I guess, tried to make a statement by they reduced the permits by five, so that the sportsman would know, you know, why they were reduced by five. So I guess hoping for maybe some peer pressure to keep that from happening again, kind of thing. The remainder of the bucks and bulls pass antlerless. There's a tie on the 250 cow tags on the fish lake, 3-3, and the chairman voted against it, so it failed. So there's no cow tags on the fish lake. Is that the okay? And that was the only change they made in the antlerless. So, and the rest passed. And all the other agenda items passed unanimously as presented by the division. So that's the board update. Kind of not very organized, but that's. I'll try to get my notes a little better together next time. Okay, are we ready for the regional update?
No, I'm fine. I'm going to stand up here to block everybody's view. Okay, I'll sit down. That's okay, it's fine. Okay, I'm going to try to keep it short tonight, but in the aquatic section, they're in the middle of doing their gill netting. In fact, today they pulled nets at Huntington North, and they did catch a couple of wipers. And they weighed about over a pound and a quarter. Justin, is that right?
Yeah, about 13 inches, pound and a quarter. Mm-hmm.
So that was good news. We hope that segment of the fishery shows up in mass soon. They will have gill netting coming up in Schofield and Joes Valley in the near future. And we have hired a new person to be the assistant aquatics manager. As you know, Paul Birdsey moved to Salt Lake, took the sport fish coordinator position up there, and Justin moved up to become the aquatics manager, and so we've just hired Calvin Black from the northeastern region. He's worked over there on Colorado River cutthroat restoration. We had a very good pool of applicants. We had four internal applicants, all really highly qualified, but we feel really good about our selection of Calvin. He will be starting towards the end of the month, so we look forward to working with him. And we're in the process of hiring a new project leader for the Moab Colorado River Fishes Project, and we've made a selection, but I don't know, are we safe to say anything yet, do you think, Justin, or? Okay. We've hired Mark Buettner, who is out of Klamath Falls, Oregon. He's worked with the Endangered Fish Program up there for 30 years, both with the Bureau and with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so he brings a wealth of experience down here, and we look forward to having him start probably towards the 1st of June or a little bit thereafter. So I think in aquatics, we're almost up to a full staff now, right? We've kind of almost gone through everybody, but we're finally there. Law enforcement, we have something exciting happening this Friday. We're going to do an aquatic invasive species checkpoint down on I-70. And I don't know if that's supposed to be classified information. But bring your boat. Was that classified, Jay?
No.
Okay, good. I should ask you before. Other than that, they've just been working bear hunters, turkey hunters, and fishermen, but a lot of good things going on. Wildlife section has been involved with surveys, including dove coo counts, breeding bird surveys, and monitoring peregrine falcons and other raptors. And I just want to take just a minute. Ernie Perkins sent this out. I don't know if he sent it to everybody, about the effects of weather on elk condition and antler mass. Have you guys, did everybody see this? Okay. This comes from Deseret Land and Livestock. Rick Danver collected this information from 1984 through 2010. I just thought it was interesting. But this is his presentation, but I'm just trying to summarize it. But he found that weather drives the system. Now, if you're looking at mature cow weights for those cows that are over a year and a half of age, that in dry years, a cow will typically weigh about 330 pounds in a moderate or medium precipitation year, weighs about 340-ish and about 355 pounds in a wet year. And that's, you know, intuitive. And also there's a relationship between cow weights and then therefore precipitation and the following year calf production. So typically on a dry year, the year following a dry year, you would have about 35 to 45, you know, calves per 100 cows that are born, and after a wet year, you're over 60. And this is a graph he put together that kind of demonstrates this. There's a time lag in there. Like I said, if you're looking at April to September precipitation from the year before and calf production the next year, which, you know, if you, you know, results in higher body weights of the cows, there's a fairly high correlation there between the calf production and that precipitation. So looking at bulls, the same kind of things apply, that the summer fall forage quality determines rut timing and length, and also winter forage and availability and winter elk body condition. Okay, but basically if you have a good, you know, good feed and a mild winter, you're going to end up with bigger antlers, you know, and if you have poor feed and a tough winter, you end up with smaller antlers. And how big of a difference does it make in antler mass? And this is measurements they've made up at Deseret Land and Livestock. Wet summers versus dry summers, and with mild wet summer, mild winter, or a dry summer with a tough winter, it the mean gross Boone and Crockett score ranges from about 345 to 330. This is just at Deseret Land and Livestock, which is a CWMU, so this isn't, you know, directly applicable to public land units, but just this is what they found. And the percent of bulls that score over 350 is about, you know, 25 to 40% on a wet summer, mild winter, versus compared to 10 to 15% on a dry summer, tough winter. And that kind of falls in line with what I heard one time at a lecture by Valerius Geist, who is a world-renowned, you know, wildlife biologist, professor at British Columbia. And he found that, you know, what he stated, that antlers are a secondary growth tissue. And so in order to have, you know, large antlers, you have to have extra forage available, you know, because the first place that protein and, you know, carbohydrates, all that goes to is just to maintain the vital organs of the animal themselves. And if you have an abundance, of course, that goes into, you know, secondary growth tissues like, you know, antlers, which are, you know, anyway, I just thought it was worth looking at. But anyway, does anybody have any questions on anything I've talked about other than the top secret AIS checkpoint this week? Because I can't talk about that. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, whole section item, conservation permit rule amendments. Kevin?
Brent, do I need to run it off? You don't have an updated one?
Yeah.
Okay. What happened to the other laptop?
It was old and got junk. So we'll need to buy one.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll be presenting
to mention the Coyote Open House.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's probably aware that through the legislative process this year, there was about $1.3 million actually allocated to the division specifically for predator control to support mule deer. And so we're building a program around that, and we're holding some open houses around the state. One of them will be in Price May 30th at the regional office, 6:30 to 8:00. And so we'll be doing some advertising, but wanted to make sure all the RAC members were aware. And if you're interested in coming, we'll be kind of rolling out how we're going to implement that program. So and be there to answer questions and take any suggestions. So. Okay, so what I'm here for to present tonight is the conservation permit rule. I'll give you a little history and some of the accomplishments, and then a brief overview of a legislative audit that happened in 2011, and then the recommended changes. So in terms of history, the program actually began in 1991 with a single bighorn sheep permit that was marketed by the Division of Wildlife. Through 1994, it was expanded to be a maximum of one permit per species. And then beginning in 1997, the program experienced fairly rapid growth. And just to illustrate that, I've done that in the about amount of money that the program raised. So in the first 17 years of the program, or 18 years of the program, from 1991 to 1998, raised $1.3 million. The next five-year period, from 1999 to 2004, $5.7 million. The next five-year period, $12.5 million. And then just in the last 2 years, the program has raised $5.3 million, which 90% of all those funds over the – and so $25 million since 1991, 90% of that goes back on the ground, habitat projects, research projects. It directly benefits wildlife in Utah. So it's been and it's one of the things that's allowed the division. If you look at all the other western states, they have a much higher percentage of their tags go to non-residents. Ours is by far the lowest. We keep many more of our tags for Utah residents, and this is one of the programs that's allowed us to do that, because it allows us to make up that difference in revenue that we don't get for non-residents. Through non-residents. So just some of the regulatory history. It's been modified at least seven times in the last 13 years, and before each rule change, we hold a meeting with the groups that participate and get their input on what's working and what's not, and then gather some input from the broader public. But just a brief result of those, in 1999, the maximum number of permits was capped for any area at 8. We also put in an evaluation formula so we could had a way to objectively evaluate performance by the groups in terms of how well they're doing in marketing their permits. And then the board made a decision that a recipient may designate another person for a permit if they're successful in the draw, so the person doesn't end up with two trophy bowl tags in 1 year or something like that. We again opened it in 2000 and made an amendment that the money can be used for other than the species that generated it, but it has to be another conservation permit species, and that's only if it's agreed upon by the division and the group. And then we added turkey, cougar, and bear statewide conservation permits in 2000. In 2002, we clarified that there could only be one application per conservation organization. We clarified that the Wildlife Board can select a recipient other than the high bidder I don't know that that's ever happened, but there is a stipulation in the rule that it considers four criteria for that. We put in criteria for limiting the growth of the program, and then the board also has the authority to authorize a second statewide conservation permit for a special event or purpose. In 2003 is when we put in and it was already operating this way, but put it in the regulation that 90% of the funds raised must be used on projects that benefit conservation permit species. We put in auditing and accounting procedures, and then project reporting and approval procedures. So you can see the program has been evolving over time. In 2006, we defined specifically the conservation permit species, and those are deer, elk, pronghorn, moose, bison, bighorn sheep, turkey, cougar, and bear. And we also instituted the multi-year conservation permit program, so now that we allocate permits on a three-year basis and put in the procedures to do that. And at that point, the board allowed for 10% of bighorn sheep permits to be used as conservation permits, whereas for all other species, it's 5%. In 2007, we added that the person identified on the permit or voucher must have a current Utah hunting or combination license. That's the same time we made the change where anybody applying in the draw had to have a hunting license as well, so to make it consistent with that. And then in 2010, there was some special Antelope Island permits, one for mule deer and one for bighorn sheep, were added. They must be authorized by both the Wildlife Board and the Parks Board, and the revenue generated by those two permits goes to the Division of Parks and Recreation and is used specifically on Antelope Island. As I mentioned, in 2011, the legislature requested that there's a specific legislative auditor that they send out to audit different programs around the state between legislative sessions, and they asked them to do the conservation permit program in 2011. And I'll just read the auditor's conclusion there. This is the final statement. They said the sale of conservation permits promotes habitat improvements on public lands with no expense to the taxpayer, while negligibly reducing the public's opportunity to draw a permit for a limited entry hunting area. And in the end, they said they encouraged the division to continue to support the program. So just briefly, some accomplishments. 309 different projects between 2006 and 2011 have been at least partially supported with conservation permit funds. Lots of big game transplants, including 561 bighorn sheep moved either into the state from out of state or within the state of Utah. Multiple pronghorn transplants with at least 350 pronghorn moved. It was conservation permit funds that supported the movement of bison from the Henry Mountains to the Book Cliffs. And then it supports some of the research that we have going, the highway mortality studies that have been going on throughout the state, specifically on Highway 6. There's a new study that's starting on the Monroe Mountain to look at the effects of predators on mule deer, specifically coyotes. The doe and fawn survival data that you hear about a lot, where we have all the collars spread around the state, that program's been being supported with conservation permit funds. And then we have some real concerns about our moose populations right now, and so we're instituting some research that's being mostly funded by conservation permits beginning this year. Just to give you a flavor of what we accomplished with this program. So then moving into the recommended rule changes. First, we're recommending that we allow turkey conservation permit holders to hunt statewide during the general season or the over-the-counter portion of the season. When last time we opened the rule, we didn't have over-the-counter turkey hunting, so this kind of makes it just consistent with the way the program runs now. We've defined that the potential number of multi-year permits is calculated based on the number of permits issued the year prior. So as I mentioned, we do it in a three-year blocks now. And so this summer and early fall, we'll be allocating permits for 2013, 2014, and 2015. The number of permits available for that three-year period will be determined by the 2012 permits that were just authorized by the board. So that's where we'll make the percentages based on the permits that were just authorized. We added in the rule a table that defines the potential number of multi-year conservation permits. Now, there's some confusion about this. And I just want to go on the record in saying this is no different than the way these have been being calculated in the past. All we're trying to do here is add transparency. This is exactly the way it has been being done for several years. And so, but it's been kind of a black box, and it wasn't specifically in the rules. So we added this in there so that everybody knows exactly how we come up with the number of permits based on the number of public permits that are in the draw. And again, no different than the way it has been. I don't foresee, or we're not trying to grow and increase the number of conservation permits with what we're doing here tonight. We've also included a mechanism for reducing the number of conservation permits for once-in-a-lifetime species if the number of permits declines during the time period for which multi-year permits are awarded. That came up specifically over the last three-year period with moose. As I mentioned, our moose populations are stable or are probably declining in some places, and so the number of public permits for moose has been going down. Yet we allocated three-year permits based on better times, prior to it would have been 2008. And so that over the last 3 years, that ratio or the percentage that have been in the conservation permit program has gotten out of whack because the number of moose permits has been going down. So this will allow us, if we see that scenario again, to pull some permits out of the conservation permit program mid-cycle so we don't have to wait till the next 3 year, till the end of the 3 year period that we're in. And then we're also recommending that we change the timing for when funds are transferred through to the division from the conservation organization for projects for which that they've committed to funding. So currently, we invoice them after projects are completed. And that's caused a lot of confusion because We estimate what a project's going to cost. Oftentimes, the projects actually come in under what was budgeted. So that, so then we invoice the groups for an amount less than what they had committed to the project, and it makes the accounting difficult on their end. So we're just putting the burden on the division. We will now keep track of that. They'll give the money up front. If there's a balance after the fact, we'll carry that over, and the next time they bid on projects, we will say, okay, here's your balance for projects that either were canceled or came in under budget, so you can spend that first before you spend the new funds that you've raised in the meantime, if that makes sense. So, and that'll take place 90 days after they've committed funding to a particular project. That's it. Appreciate your time and be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions from the RAC?
I got a question. On the table here, then, eight has been the maximum.
It has been, and it's, it will remain
the maximum.
Yeah.
And then on the number four, the option for reducing the number of permits, hopefully, I don't know. Is there a vice versa? If the once-in-a-lifetime species permits are increasing?
No, we haven't put them. We specifically held that back.
If
that happens, then they'll get their bump at the beginning of the next three-year period.
Okay.
And partially what we do, Todd, is there's a three-year program and there's a one-year program. So if we see increases during the cycle, there's two groups. Right now it's Ducks Unlimited and the Utah Bowman's Association are only doing it on a one-year amount of time. And so if we see increases, we use those increases to allocate a couple of permits to the groups that are in the one-year program. We don't give anything to the groups that are already in the multi-year program, which are the larger groups, SFW, RMEF, Mule Deer Foundation.
I don't see it in here, but I think the whole RAC received an email from Concerned Public that talked about language. It would change it from maximum number to rounding. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about with that table. The rule used to read a maximum of 5%, a maximum of 10% for the different things. Right or wrong, we've been rounding, even though that's what the rule said, for the last several years. So although it appears like a change, all we're trying to do is make it completely transparent on what has been happening and what we plan on continuing to do.
So when you're looking at three, you know, on page 3A where it says the 5 to 14 permits and one conservation, 10 permits there would have been that 10%.
Would have made it to maximum.
Would have made it to maximum. You've
right.
always been going down to
We've
5.
We've always been
Nothing
going with
new
that.
There, that's always
that's,
been
that's, yeah. And like I said, even the legislative auditors, when they looked at the program, didn't see that as an issue, and that's the way it had been being happening. Probably maybe strictly not in line with the way the rule read, but operationally it's the way it's been happening. So.
Any other questions from the RAC? Do we have any questions from the audience, public? Okay, we'll go to comments from the public. Any comments from the public? Thanks. Appreciate you filling out that card. Anybody else that would like to visit or talk, if you fill out one of these yellow cards, we'd appreciate it.
Troy Jessenson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. We'd just like to encourage the RAC to support the division and the changes they made to the conservation permit rule. We believe this is a huge benefit to all public, both non-consumptive and hunters, to put more wildlife on the mountain, so we'd encourage you to vote for it. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. Any other comment from the public? No further comment from the public. We'll open it up to the RAC for discussion.
Is there some reason we're striking the language in a maximum of in two places? We're striking language, a maximum of 10% of the toll permits, and then a maximum of 5%. Why are we striking that language?
We thought with having the tables in there and showing exactly how it's happening that was redundant, and it's probably not really a maximum. You know, it's the way it's been happening, and it probably you know, in the strictest sense, we probably weren't in absolute alignment with that, with the way we've been doing it. And that's where the confusions come. Some people are reading that as we're trying to grow the program and add conservation permits. We're not. All we're trying to do is add transparency to the rule so everybody knows exactly how do you get to 2, how do you get to 3, how do you get to 4.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, because I was under that impression as well.
Right, yeah. And several people have been. And you know, right or wrong, it's the way we've been doing it. So.
Thank you.
Travis wasn't able to be here tonight, but he did send an email. Do you have a copy of it? Or?
I didn't bring it, but
I might have.
Oh, I probably have it on my phone, too.
Look at Bill, all high tech.
Yeah.
Let's see if he can make it work.
Let's see if I can find it, huh? Oh, Travis Pearson, yeah. Okay, he says, I'm not going to be able to make it to the RAC meeting tonight. Would you let them know the only item I am concerned about is a conservation permit rule change? I'm opposed to it and want it to stay as is. Thanks, Travis.
Well, he didn't tell us why, did he?
Didn't.
Thanks for nothing, Trav.
I assume it was based on the confusion of the thing we just talked about.
Yeah.
And in the way it reads in there, there's
the same, right?
It's where it's, you know, when you look at dropping that 5, you're going to a 20% instead of a 10%, but it's the overall is what you're looking at. That's why you're taking out the maximum verbiage on that. Okay.
I think he, before the meeting, a lot of us may have had the same concerns that Travis may have sent that email on. This did clarify.
Yeah. I personally, I feel the conservation permit program has been a great program. It's allowed the division to have some funding for things that they'd have never been able to fund through just their general budget. But I also feel like in this day where opportunity versus quality has taken opportunity away, I think I don't think we want to go any higher. So. As long as we're staying status quo on the number of conservation tags, I feel good about supporting it.
And I'll echo that. I am fortunate in being able to have the opportunity to put some of that money on the ground, and we through the agencies have an opportunity that we would never have to use money on habitat projects. So I echo that, but I also, like Darris, have heard from the public of a great concern of that, of growing that. But I do support keeping that number where we are and a big supporter of putting that money back on the ground.
That almost sounded like a motion.
And just to clarify, so that it's completely clear, the number is going to continue to go up and down a little bit based on the number of permits that are out there, but we're not changing the way we're getting to that number at all. That's what's staying consistent.
We're not taking permits away from the
We're not. We're calculating in the same way we have been. So.
Ready for a motion?
Sure. I will make a motion to accept the rule as presented.
Second that.
We have a motion from Kevin to accept the conservation permit rule amendment as presented, seconded by Chris Mikos. All in favor? Opposed? Unanimous. Okay, Paul. Production and importation and possession rule amendments. That was a fun read.
Just try it several times. I just feel sorry for the person who had to write that.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the title. I'm talking about the material you sent us.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. My name is Paul Birdsey. As Bill mentioned earlier, I'm the Coldwater Sport Fish Coordinator in Salt Lake, and I've been asked to come and talk about the collection, importation, transportation, possession of animal, or CIP, rule. Now, some of you may remember that the Salt Lake office brought this same rule out to the RACs about a year or a year and a half ago. During that RAC process, however, there were some significant problems identified with that version of the rule. So it's gone back to a drawing board, been working on it, and this is the second go-around. What I want to present tonight, however, is all of the changes that are happening to the rule, not just those changes that have been incorporated since the last time it was out, you know, a year or so ago, because I understand that there are some new RAC members that may not have been around when it was brought out previously. Hey, first of all, what is the CIP? It's a cooperative rule with the DWR, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Health with the purpose of regulating possession of wildlife, protecting health, safety, and welfare of the public, and protect the genetic integrity of wildlife and livestock. And it provides a mechanism for the DWR to regulate activities for protected wildlife unrelated to hunting and sport fishing, and specifically governs the issues of certificates of registration, or CORs, to allow collection, importation, possession, etc., of protected wildlife, and defines those activities which a COR is required. There are three different levels of wildlife classification in the rule. There's a non-controlled, controlled, and prohibited, depending on what their impact could be to the populations or to potentially to native species for the possession of a non-native species. With the prohibited, the COR is only issued in accordance with the CIP rule and federal laws. Species that are not covered by this rule are cats, and that definition has been defined as saying only recognized domestic breeds, dogs, and that's domestic dogs or hybrids of them, and swine, that's domestic or feral. Now, the question came up last night, which was fortunate Kevin was there to answer, but I'll try and forestall that. If the pigs come from a domestic stock and then escape or are put out for a feral hog hunt, then those are controlled by the, or come under the authorization of the Department of Agriculture. If they originate with a wild stock, such as the Russian boar, then they would come under the authorization of the Division of Wildlife Resources. Okay, domestic, the definition was added, and it's been defined as those animals that are commonly considered domestics. If we say cow, horse, whatever, everyone knows what we're talking about. Animal, the definition now includes hybrids of domestic and wild animals. And probably the biggest change in this rule is the definition of ornamental fish. It's been revised to say ornamental aquatic animal species, and that is so that it includes mollusks and crustaceans, which the ornamental fish terminology did not. And those species are those commonly cultured and sold in the aquarium industry. They do not include sport fish, bait fish, food fish, native species, prohibited or controlled species. Now, you need to be aware that if you vote to accept this rule, you will also be revising the definition of ornamental fish in the R657-16 aquaculture and fish stocking and the R657-59 fish ponds rule to this ornamental aquatic animal species. This definition is, or this term is also found in the brine shrimp rule, but we're not opening that rule for revision on this term right now because it's a complex rule and I believe it needs to get revised in the next year or so anyway, so we're just going to hold off on that. But just be aware that that definition is found in several places. For the crustaceans and mollusks, we added a couple of species here to the prohibited list. They're native species, Pylos crayfish. That's the only native crayfish in Utah, and it's facing threats from two introduced crayfish. And in an amphipod, which is a small aquatic invertebrate. There's one endemic species found in Duchesne County, It was petitioned to list under the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service determined that the petition was not substantial, and that simply means that the petitioners did not include enough information in the petition to warrant further discussion. Doesn't mean that it won't be petitioned again. Moving on, clarification and some of the definitions. The floater, which I've been asked to remind everybody, does not refer to something that's occasionally found in public swimming pools, but it is a clam, a bivalve. There are actually several different species. In the previous version of rule, it was only listed as a California floater. This one now just says floater, and it covers all the Anadonta species. And the spring snails of that particular genus, some of those snails are found in only a single spring in the West Desert, so their existence is very tenuous, so we don't want anybody collecting those. We also added the native terrestrial snail called the southern tight coil to the controlled, the western pearl shell, which is prohibited. There's been no observations of this particular species since the 1940s. However, nobody's gone out and looked for them either. So, and then finally, one non-native, the red rim melania. Yeah, Greek and Latin were never my strong points, so if you know how to pronounce that, I apologize. It is very detrimental to non-native species, and it is prohibited for collection, importation, possession. And I need to mention that right now we're dealing with the ornamental fish and ornamental aquatic animal species as a group, saying if they're commonly found in the pet trade. However, we are working on trying to do more work with illegally introduced species, and we'll likely be coming out with more work on that in the next year or so. Melanoides happens to be one that is fairly prevalent in the pet trade, and it is causing a lot of problems in least chub restoration areas in western Utah County. So just be aware that in the future we're gonna try and nail this down a little tighter. Okay. Real briefly, all native species are classified as controlled for collection, importation, possession, and all non-native species are classified as prohibited unless they're identified elsewhere in the rule as being allowed. For the fish, we added three species to the prohibited list, the blue catfish, the emerald shiner, and the burbot. These are three species that are non-native, and they can be detrimental to either native or sport fish populations. For mammals, except as prohibited in non-game mammals rule, a person is allowed to kill non-game mammals that are causing damage to their property or crops. A second to read that. And we remove the option to capture and relocate porcupine, striped skunk, and squirrels. For birds, a person is not required to obtain a certificate of registration or a federal permit to kill blackbird, billed magpies, cowbirds, house sparrows, European starlings, and domestic pigeons when found damaging personal or real property. And you can keep the parts, including plumage and other parts, for non-commercial personal use. Raptors, updated This rule to reflect recent federal changes in the falconry rule. Formal approval from the division is required to transfer a raptor from a falconry certificate to a propagation certificate that exceeds 8 months in duration. A propagator may temporarily possess a falcon for propagation without division approval, provided the propagator possesses a signed and dated statement from the falconer authorizing the temporary possession. Canada Goose Nest Egg Registry was created by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2007 to deal with nuisance geese. Allows agencies and landowners who register online to destroy goose nests and eggs on their property within urban environments from March 1st to June 30th. The take of adults and goslings is not allowed. They must report their activities annually online, and we're amending this to allow these activities under state regulations in compliance with the federal rule. And this is because Canada geese have become a nuisance problem in many areas that there is little help for that problem otherwise. Allows the affected landowners to deal with some of the problem, and it's not expected to have any real impact on the wild population. That, I'll take any questions.
Questions from the RAC.
Yes, sir.
Well, you listed it's okay to kill magpies, cowbirds, et cetera, but it doesn't say anything about the means of doing that. And I'm just wondering if, obviously, you can't shoot them inside of a city limit, generally.
Right. That would have to be in accordance with either city or county ordinance.
Are there any other means or ways of doing it, or if it would be legal?
I don't know. You'd have to check with your county or city, I think.
Could we include the banded doves that we have around?
Eurasian colonists.
They're not protected, so they are included. And there are some products on the market. Some of them you have to get through federal agencies, but, you know, lethal means of removing those other birds that are causing damage.
Do you have to get a permission to kill ravens and crows, or can you just, are they unprotected too, or what's the deal with those?
Ravens and crows are protected federally. There is actually a depredation order on one or the other right now, and so you can get a permit to remove them.
How do you get a permit? You got to go to the feds to get that?
No, we can issue a permit, a COR. For those, because there is a depredation order. If there wasn't a depredation order, then we wouldn't be able to do anything about it either.
Okay. Any other questions from the RAC? Any questions from the audience? Any comments from the audience? Discussion. Motion from the RAC?
Make a motion to accept the rule as presented.
Second.
Motion was made by Kevin to accept the collection, importation, and possession rule amendment, seconded by Charlie Tracy. All in favor? Unanimous? Division variance rule. Come on, Greg. Got in trouble last time. Anybody need to take a break? Okay, we'll just stare at Greg then and make him really nervous until he hurries and gets it done.
Budget on there?
Bring that one up.
Sweet.
Grab that, Kevin. Some reach over and grab it.
Not on there, we will be.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and RAC members. Sorry about that. Tonight we'll be presenting the change to Rule R657-57, which is called the Division Variance Rule. Most of you probably aren't familiar with what that is, what this rule even is, so I'll give you a short background on it. The Variance Rule is a rule that was put in place about 4 years ago. To address issues that arise with individuals who become ill or injured or have some other situations arise after they've, generally after they've drawn a hunting permit and are hoping for some form of relief because of the circumstances that have arisen. So that rule created a division variance committee to address these people who have injury or illness or military activation. And it basically said that you got to come to us with this situation within 200 days after the season closes, and you cannot have hunted. So the board itself still handles some things that this committee doesn't handle, but we're able to address most of them internally in the division. The general result of these variance requests is that we let people have a season extension into the following hunt year. We'll talk about what makes you qualify for those. But to give you an idea of sort of the distribution of how those are occurring is about 60% of them are for people who become ill or injured. About a third are from immediate family member illness, a few from military, and a few for other reasons. So that's kind of the reasons that variances have been addressed. This graph here is kind of what the situation that's arisen that's made us want to come back out and talk to you about or make a proposal to change this rule. Before the rule, on the left, those three columns, those were situations that arose and we would take to the Wildlife Board. There's roughly 20 or so a year that were happening, and the Wildlife Board heard those situations. After this rule got put in place, it started to become a little bit better known that if something happened to you, you could get some relief without going to the Wildlife Board, and it kind of streamlined the process. Might have streamlined it a little bit too much. And we're kind of concerned that with continued growth pattern like this, with the ability to push a lot of these hunts into a future years, it's going to maybe start impacting the resources, because all of these permits would be added on top of the next year's permit recommendations. And it wasn't such a big deal before, but and it's probably not that huge yet, but if we kind of keep this exponential growth, it may be at some point down the road. So we try to come up with some solutions that'll still address the individual's concerns who find themselves in the situation, but maybe not allow things to get too out of hand. The blue or the taller columns are the ones that the division committee that was created in 2008 is addressing. And there's still a few circumstances where they have to go to the board. That's the lower columns or the ones in red there. Typically, those ones that go to the board are situations where people got ill or injured or had some circumstance arise after they'd already started into their hunt. So maybe they had a 2-week-long bull elk hunt. They hunted for a week and hadn't harvested and got hurt, and they wanted to come to the board and say, hey, can I hunt next year, whatever, because I hadn't killed one yet, and, you know, I really don't want to you know, lose all these bonus points, whatever. So those ones go to the board. And some of those the board has approved, and others they've not. But all of the ones that were approved by the division, none of those individuals had an opportunity to hunt yet. So our basis for the change in this rule was to basically realize that all of us can have unforeseen events in life. You know, nobody here right now thinks that you might draw a permit here in a few weeks when you're notified, and then, you know, sometime between now and this fall get hurt. But if it happens, it's kind of a big deal, especially if you had 18 or 19 bonus points or any number of bonus points. It doesn't matter. You know, you don't want to see that opportunity go away. But secondly, we also got to acknowledge that we can't just extend everything in the future without at some point having an impact on the resource. And lastly, we've got to make sure we don't do something that hurts the division financially. You know, we're not totally in the business of ensuring that everybody's life goes perfect all the time on a financial basis. So. Okay, so what is variance relief going to be under this proposal? We may grant a variance if you're substantially precluded from hunting because of personal illness or injury, death of an immediate family member, military deployment. And the change we're making here is that instead of 200 days, you've got to notify us within 120 days of the season closure. Okay, there's still no guarantee that we're going to do an extension. Sometimes we've got to look at things like illness and determine, you know, were you really ill enough that it precluded you from being able to go hunt or not, or you just, you know, faking it, I guess. So, substantially precluded. Now, this is kind of a big change. In the old rule, it said if you hunted at all, you got to go to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board struggled with it, and they did approve a lot of them because they realized that sometimes when you draw these quality opportunities, you don't want to go out on the first day of your hunt and shoot the first animal that you see. You're kind of looking for, you know, the best you can. So what we've said here in this recommendation is if you've hunted for one day or less and you didn't harvest anything, we'll consider that to where you basically hadn't hunted. So up to a day of hunting and not harvesting, we'll say that you were still substantially precluded. If you had more than a day of hunting opportunities, we're going to say, well, maybe you should have harvested, or, you know, sorry that you weren't.
Greg?
Lucker.
On the paper here, it says two or less days hunting in the field.
We kick this around a lot, and then I think Stacy on Monday of this week sent you all out a revised change, and we changed it from 2 days to one. In fact, that was really the main change, so that's a good catch, but it had been 2 days. Okay, variances are limited to, and these are kind of things that are available to us now, but we're going to change the way they're weighted a little bit. One is waive a waiting period waiver, or the waiting period. Bonus and preference point restoration and season extension. So what the second one is, bonus and preference point restoration, is basically saying, okay, this event happened to you, rather than extending it in some of these categories, we're going to give you your points back. Okay, give us the permit back. We'll give you all your points back plus the one you'd earned for that year. And it kind of is like this whole, like you'd never drawn that year. It's kind of like, whoops, you didn't draw. And it gives you an opportunity to draw again. So that's a direction we want to go to rather than doing so many season extensions. And hopefully that would work out well for the individuals. Now, we wouldn't give people their money back. So we're not saying here's your points back and here's all your money back. You know, there is some burden you're going to take, and we feel like, you know, some fortunate things happen in life, but we don't want to, you know, give a lot of money back to people because we probably don't have an opportunity to resell that permit in most cases. Okay, so what species are we talking about restoring preference points on? Any of these general permits, general deer, antlerless ones, swans, sage grouse, okay, these are not eligible for a season extension. You'd get your preference point back, like I just described. Bonus point, same thing. You're not eligible for an extension. You get your points back on these things plus one for that year's draw. All right, and it would be, we'll start with the bottom ones. Once in a lifetime, limited entry, public CWMU, antlerless moose. And on the first category, sportsman and convention, you didn't have any points to draw that. We can't give you your points back. But this is the situation where we're going to waive your waiting period so you can go back in and keep applying. Right now, if you draw some of these permits, we go in and basically erase your bonus points or eligibility maybe for like once in a lifetime. So we'd give you that eligibility back to keep trying for those. But we don't really have any points to give you back. One thing that did come up in a lot of internal discussions is on that category of once in a lifetime, is that a category that we think ought to give you, because it's kind of hard to draw those in most cases. Do we want to allow people with once in a lifetime to have a season extension because there's not that many of them and it's harder to draw? So we almost recommended that. But then we also had some discussion that said, you know what, a San Juan Bull Elk tag is as hard to draw as a lot of once in a lifetime. And if we throw everything in the extension category, that's where we're at right now. So we struggle, but that may be something you want to at least address in your conversations here. For now, it's recommended to just be getting your points back. Season extensions. Now, there's a few that we've recommended extensions on. And it's conservation, poaching reward, which we've never actually even had any of those requests, a variance, because there's just a few a year. Private CWMUs and limited entry landowner. The private CWMUs, it would be subject to the CWMU operator agreeing to let them have that permit next year on top of the other permits that they'd be issued. So if they don't, if they don't agree to that, then they couldn't have an extension. That would be something that the hunter would have to work out with the landowner. The reason that these categories, we're saying why extension here, is because these people could buy these early in a calendar year through a different banquet or whatever. And they may do that in February. The hunt's that fall, and if they're injured at some point, they got another 120 days after that to contact us. It could be a year after they bought that before we ever have them come to us and say, hey, I got injured or whatever. And the problem is, if we can help them out with the things we can help out with, maybe points or waivers for, you know, being able to participate again. But the challenge is these conservation groups may have long spent that money. So if someone paid $20,000 for elk permit, they may have spent that money 6 or 8 months before on a habitat project or whatever. It's hard for us to say, well, why don't you go back to the conservation group and get your money back, or a private CWMU guy or whomever. They probably don't have the money to give back. So these kinds of permits are generally pretty low in numbers, and we feel like it's just they have elements that are out of our control as far as being able to help these individuals out. So those are the only categories we've recommended season extensions on. As far as groups, this is another change. What we've said is, because we're not doing extensions too much now, if people apply as groups, we'd be willing to allow the whole group to have the same relief as individuals. So let's say two people put in for limited entry bull elk and they both get it, and then one of them's injured enough they can't hunt. What we have now is a lot, you know, we're helping the one guy out. Here, you can have extension, and then you got the other group member going, well, I was going to hunt with this individual. Maybe it's another family member, or maybe these people are from out of state or whatever. And it's hard to have two people hunting now in two different years. So what we're saying is, we'll let these individuals move through the system together. And again, it's basically just giving them their points back. So it's not like they're getting some, you know, as great of an opportunity as we offer them right now. The last thing to talk about, and this is kind of a biggie, is most all of our rules, if the individual doesn't like some component, they can appeal it to the wildlife board. The problem is, if we tell everybody, well, here's the relief you have, you know, you can have your points back, whatever. If that individual doesn't like that right now, they can go to the board and say, hey, can you treat me different? And here's my sad situation, why? And so what we've done here is we're actually limiting the board's ability. And if all these categories ring true, 120 days, you hunted more, and I apologize, the number two, it should say more than one day. I forgot to change the slide. Season extensions are on those categories. They harvested. if these are the case, they can't even appeal this to the board. And that's quite a shift. This will be the only rule we have that says it's unappealable to the board. But I think the board wants that, and we feel like this will kind of keep it fair to everyone rather than people just saying, well, I don't like what the division said. I'm going to go get the board to change it. So I know that's a lot, and this is something that the RACs often don't deal with, but it's kind of a big deal in our world dealing with all these situations. And the board spends, for some of you who have been to board meetings, they have almost every board meeting, they have one or two or three or five of these things they have to address, and it takes a lot of time. So we're trying to move away from some of that as well. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Any questions from the RAC?
On those the convention tags, they fell under the bonus point restoration waiting period waiver. You don't have bonus points there. And as I correct me if I'm wrong, like especially with sheep, there's no waiting period to if you draw a sheep tag there at the convention, there's no waiting period anyway, right?
There's not there, but if you draw a convention once in a lifetime, we do make you ineligible to go back to the division and apply. So you can keep drawing those at the convention, but you can't come back and apply for that species again through the regular big game draw. So this would say, oh, okay, you couldn't hunt, you turned it in. Now you're back to being eligible to apply for that sheep with your 14 points in that different world. So that's what that is. It's kind of the waiting period waiver.
Thank you.
The 2 days of hunting, or the 1 day hunting, is that an honor system type thing?
It kind of has to be, really. A lot of this kind of has to be the honor system. You know, are you really injured bad enough that you couldn't have participated? That's what we look at a lot. You know, you sprained your ankle, you know. Does sprain your ankle mean you're kind of gimping around, or you really sprained it seriously and you can't even step on it, you know? And, some things are obvious. And honestly, this isn't really a heavily abused system, I don't believe. Most of these people have had very, very serious situations. They're not coming into us with, you know, sprained ankles. These are cancer, car wrecks, you know, typically pretty serious situations, you know. So we're not trying to undermine it. We just don't want to keep pushing all these permits out into future years. It's kind of what we're getting at here.
Any other questions from the RAC? From the audience? Comments from the audience? Discussion, motion?
Move to accept as presented.
We have a motion from Todd to accept the division variance rule amendment as proposed, seconded by Kevin. All in favor? Unanimous? Deer management plans.
Thanks, yes, Mr. Chairman. Right. Let's hope none of you ever have to become part of this rule.
Today I'm going to give the presentation on the mule deer management plans. It's at a statewide level, but I'm going to focus mostly on the southeast region. So the reason these are being presented is all unit plans expired in 2011, and so we got to update everyone statewide. And the way that the plans are written is you outline boundaries. There's a given boundary description on each unit. And then we address the management goals. What is it that we're really trying to accomplish? Those are followed by objectives. And then the strategies for not only deer populations but their associated habitats are then outlined as well. And I just want to point out for these plans, there's no changes from the 2006 plans. That for the Southeast region, they're just being updated. And the way I've set up this presentation is as if you were flipping through the plan, if you were following along. So we'll start with the boundaries and move forward. So in the Southeast region, we have four general season units. The Nine Mile Unit, the La Salle's, the San Juan, and then the Manti is combined with the San Rafael Swell. We also have two limited entry units, the Dolores Triangle and Elk Ridge, and one premium limited entry unit, which is the Henry Mountains. I didn't write the boundary descriptions. I thought a visual would explain that better. So the goals of this plan, what we'd like to do on these units is manage for a healthy population of animals capable of providing a broad range of recreational activities, including hunting and viewing. We also want to manage mule deer with their associated habitats, and so we want to maintain populations at levels within the long-term capability of the available habitat. And then finally, this is a big effort that we've had, which has really been vamped up over the last 7-8 years, is to improve and protect mule deer habitat. And so these are the goals of each unit plan. Some of the content that you'll find in here, and I've tried to summarize these, and we can spend as much time on these as you want. We have the units on the far left column, the units and their subunits, followed by the long-term population objective. And if you look at the Dolores Triangle, there in about the middle of the slide, you'll see there's a 5,100 highlighted in yellow. And what that represents is the short-term population objective. And so what we have is, if conditions are great, this is what we want to manage our populations to, these long-term objectives. But on the Dolores Triangle, in 2006, the plan we had there, we had a lot of winter range degradation, and so we actually reduced that long-term population objective by 20%. And so that's what that indicates. The column in the middle, we have total acres of deer habitat for each unit. And our unit plans address predator management. And we also summarized a DCI score. The DCI stands for Desirable Component Index, and it's just to give you an idea of how the range is for mule deer, specifically for mule deer. And these good, fair, fair to poor, what we did to summarize this presentation, because we have so many range sites, is sat down and kind of looked at all of our range trend and said, okay, some are good, some are poor, the majority are fair. For the unit, it's probably fair. So the plans go into that more, though. So. Okay, population strategies. A big part of what we want to do with these plans is monitoring. And we've given the RAC a presentation, what was that, 2 years ago, a year ago, where we talked about what we do with collecting buck-to-doe ratios and harvest and different things like that. I don't know if you guys remember. Maybe it's time to do it again. I don't know.
It was before we had the changes, the RAC member changes.
Yeah. I can't remember. It all runs together. But
I think it was right when we got the new members.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea of that presentation, if you can dig deep and remember some of that, was how do we collect data? Why do we collect it? How do we use it? And really that drives the monitoring portion of the population strategies and our plans. The other thing we wanted to address was limiting factors. Crop depredation, habitat, predation, highway mortality, disease, illegal harvest, et cetera. You know, some of those specific ones, and what are our plans to minimize and mitigate some of those. Moving away from mule deer and going back to their habitats, we also want to monitor the range trend studies that we have. I mean, what kind of what condition are these ranges in to support mule deer? And so we want to continue our efforts with range trend studies and also spring range assessments. You know, biologists going out on the ground and looking at how much sagebrush has been hedged and pellet counts and different things like that. We also want to protect and maintain our habitat. And I think our habitat section really should be applauded for the efforts that they've done over the last decade. I mean, they've really done a good job of minimizing impacts, mitigate for losses, and trying to create more habitat. And And that's kind of the momentum that we want to continue on with moving forward in these plans. And finally, improvements. I think we have a lot of strong partnerships with federal agencies and private individuals and NGOs and lots of sportsmen's groups and really using all that momentum and those resources to make better mule deer habitats. So, one thing we also want to move forward with is tonight you're getting presented statewide recommendations for management plans everywhere. I do want to point out that the southeast region and the northeast region, we're using the most up-to-date information we have because the range trend crew has recently been through, and so our plans are very thorough. You look at the northern region, they just had their range trend read last year. They'll get that data summarized this year, and once that's implemented, every year we will have one region's management plans coming around instead of all five. And so this is kind of a shotgun approach tonight, but there will be a lot more specific details in plans after range trends come through. And that's what I have for mule deer plans. So thank you.
Any questions from the RAC?
So basically that analysis will be on a five-year rotation based on that. That's what the region, what the range crew does.
Yeah. So right now, yeah, good question. So our range trend goes from one region to the next every year. So every 5 years, we have a heavy in-depth analysis of our habitat condition. The year following that, we will update our management plan. So that way, it's just trying to get back to managing mule deer to the habitat, which is the best management concept. So
the next time we review the management plan for Southeast Utah would be 2015?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I just have a question on the boundary for the San Juan unit. Is it reflect the one that was passed by the...
It does, yeah, the change that we made last year, yeah. Yeah, where it comes... It doesn't go up to north of Moab and come down at the Cane Springs Wash down to... Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions from the RAC? From the audience? Comments from the audience? Discuss last motion from the RAC? We have a motion to accept the deer management plan as presented by Pam. Do we have a second?
Second.
Wayne? Second. All those in favor? Unanimous. The bigger ones.
Okay. Moving on. We'll get into the elk management portion of this. So again, elk plans expired last year, and we're updating them on a statewide level, and the bulk of my presentation will specifically revolve around the southeast region. Very similar to mule deer. You can almost just take mule deer out, put elk, and the structure of the plan is the same. And for the southeast region, this isn't statewide, southeast region, we have no changes from the 2006 plans. And I think that date's wrong. I think that's the 2008 plans that were previously passed. So I apologize for that. And there are changes statewide, and we'll get to that at the end. But for the region, no changes. The goals, again, very similar. We want to manage for healthy, robust populations of elk and provide the public with recreation activities, including hunting and viewing. We want to manage elk in association with their long-term capability of habitat potential and improve and protect habitat for these animals as well. Again, we have our units on the left with their associated subunits. The long-term population objectives for the southeast region, none of these have changed. And again, the Dolores Triangle, we're managing to a short-term population objective just because of some of the habitat issues that we're having there. And we will increase that to the long term. We'll propose that to be increased to the long term population objective once those rebound. Age objectives for these various units range from 5.5 to 6 year olds all the way to trophy bulls on the San Juan. And there's any bull hunting opportunities mixed throughout. And again, the total acres of elk habitat on the far right. Population strategy, again, we want to monitor harvest, age data, population size, get those ratios, and really get a feel for how our elk herds are doing on these units. Limiting factors are very similar to mule deer. With the exception is probably distribution of elk. That seems to be more of a factor. You can have a unit that has 1,000 elk, but if they're all congregated in one drainage, that's an issue. And so dealing with the spatial component of elk was included in this as well. How's that, Brent? Sorry, I just had to wake everybody up. Sorry, Pam. Sorry, I just saw Bill's white socks, and it just made me get out of hand. Okay, statewide level, these are the changes that we have. The northern region, they're calling for increases on the Chalk Creek and the Camas units. The northeast region is looking to increase. They're proposing an increase of 350 elk. The West Desert in the central region, an increase of 150 elk. The Paunsagunt, they're reducing their elk population objective by 35. There's less than 200 elk on that unit anyways, population objective. I think this puts it down to about 140. The Fillmore, Pavant, and the Plateau Fish Lake in the southern region are also asking for increases, 175 animals on Pavant and 800 on the Fish Lake. So statewide, what are we doing with our elk herd? Through these unit management plans, we're looking for an increase of a little over 2,000 elk. Okay, moving from animals to habitat, again, we want to monitor that and continue to look at range and how it's doing in relation to our elk numbers and distribution. We also want to protect and maintain the habitat we have, and also address access issues. This comes up a lot of time with private land issues, or on the case of, say, like an elk ridge where we'd like to get some cows killed, but it's so remote. How do you do that? With elk, it's tougher issues with access and distribution and things like that, and these plans try to tackle some of those factors. And finally, improvements. I mean, we want to make more feed and do more habitat projects to benefit these species. Yes.
Do you have range trend studies at higher elevations? When I've looked at those studies, most of them look like they were primarily winter habitat for deer. And so I'm not sure what range trend studies you're looking at for the elk.
Yeah, so recently we've kind of had a shift in focus when it comes to range trend. I mean, for a long time, I don't want to say it was exclusively on winter ranges or transitional ranges, but I think a lot of us are identifying exactly what you're saying, and that is that the summer habitat has a lot of value, and that needs to be monitored as well. And I know in our region, when the range trend came through, we traded out some low-elevation sites to try to get a feel for some of those higher elevation sites. I think there's a shift that way, but you're right, the majority are lower elevation.
Kevin can probably talk about some of the ones we do at the Forest Service.
Yeah, I do appreciate the process. Each year that the range trend crew is going to come in, going to be in our region, the agencies are invited to look at those, and each time that they're going to go into look at each site, and the agencies and the DWR discuss those, the validity, what species that has given us a range trend for, and many times we have moved those. I think now, at least on the north zone of the Manti, we've got a pretty good mix of high elevation and low elevation.
Yeah, I just still, it sounds like things are going to maybe be better in the future, but if you look at the range trend studies, they're really comprehensive, and they go back to the 1980s.
Yeah.
And so we actually have, you know, a good, at this point, about 30 years for most of the deer habitat, but not really for...
There is some elk habitat, though. We do go out and do, not in conjunction with the with range trend, but with other agencies, we go and read some transects, some of those every year on specific elk ranges. And so we do have some indication of that, but it's not published in the range trend study.
And Wayne, those range trend studies, I'm sure you know, I mean, they are very, very inclusive. And there's been times where we've wanted to go in and look at things that really had nothing to do with mule deer habitat, like nested frequency of grasses and different things like that. And you can pick that out because the data they collect is so robust. It's targeted for mule deer, obviously, because that's been the focus, but I think they're still pliable enough to get some good valuable information. But and they are moving up, like Bill said, in elevation.
That's an incredible
Sure.
When we are we voting just on the southeastern then, or we're voting on the entire state? Like these others that want to increase their objectives, we're voting on that as well.
Yeah, it'll be statewide.
So what's driven those increases outside of our region?
So most of these are in areas that are already over objective. And so they put committees together and said, well, we're already X amount of elk over. We know that that we can grow the elk here. And a lot of places, they're difficult to get at. I mean, you look at some of the private land issues in the northern region, and just some areas where they're there. And so it was, well, can we change the objective and get some support? In most cases, yeah.
So the habitat supports it, and there's no conflicts with grazing?
I think with elk, you're always going to have conflicts. But I think with the committees that they put together, you know, I talked to Teresa in the southern region today, and she says, yeah, the committees we put together, it wasn't unanimous, but with them there were split votes and support for increases in the change. And so, yeah.
I guess it'd probably be good to point out that what happened at the southern region last night when they considered those increases. Maybe
it did pass, right?
Six
above. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, that means you can increase tax too, though.
Yeah, I mean, with an increase in total elk, there's an increase in opportunity both for cows and bulls and down the road. So, yeah.
Any other questions? Questions, Vince?
Oh, he's Wayne.
Oh, sorry, Wayne. Go ahead.
Okay, so for about 5 years, I've been working with cattlemen in the Tusher Range. And always our conclusion was that we would ask the DWR to decrease the number of elk in that unit. And I don't think I've ever seen any inclination of the DWR to do that. This was something that was agreed upon amongst many stakeholders in a long process. And yet, it doesn't seem to be happening. I'm curious, does the DWR really think that the Tusher Range is not overstocked with ungulates?
I wish I could speak to it, Wayne, but I don't.
Okay.
I don't know that area.
That's over by Beaver?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
We have an ex-Forest Service employee from over there who can respond. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know that I can't speak to the Tusher, but I do know that on the Manti, we do have a high number of elk, close to 12,000. But we have, instead of cattle grazing, we have sheep grazing with close to 45,000 sheep permitted on the mountain with only... I believe under 10 allotments of cattle, and we do see an amazingly pretty good recruitment of aspen, I think is one of your questions, so for what that's worth. I can't speak to the beaver and the tusher.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience? State your name, Eric, would you?
Eric Luke. I'm just representing myself. Justin, do the increases here also represent one of the factors, all the habitat work that has been done in those areas? I know the Fish Lake in particular, there's been a tremendous amount of habitat work done. Is that a deciding factor for raising the numbers as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a part of it. And I heard I heard some numbers a week or two ago on what we've done statewide for big game, and it was in the neighborhood of $70 million and 600,000 acres over the last 7 years or so. And yeah, I guess to be responsible, I don't think we would recommend increases if our agency felt that the habitat couldn't support it. So.
Any other questions, comments from the audience? Troy Justison, representing SFW.
Yep, Troy Justison, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. I had the opportunity to sit on several of these committees on the elk, and I attended the RAC meeting last night in the southern region. You know, speaking specifically towards the Fish Lake and some of those there, Director Karpowitz stated in the board meeting last week that a total of $16 million and over 220,000 acres have been treated in that particular area. There was some confusion amongst the BLM and Forest Service that some of the biologists that are involved with the habitat restoration there said there is ample feed to increase not only the elk but grazing there. And then some of the upper echelon employees within the BLM and the Forest Service said, no, that's not the fact, we are opposed to it. So there was some discrepancy there. But it's SSW's position that, you know, we would ask the RAC to vote to support the division's recommendations here. Sportsmen have invested a lot of dollars within this to grow this herd, and we're sympathetic to the ranchers and the cattlemen, too, and think that if the forage is available, that their allotments ought to be restored also. Thank you.
Any other comments? Discussion from the RAC.
Have any of those allotments been, I guess nobody would know that if their grazing has been increased. Would you guys know anything about that?
Is Kevin still here?
I believe Kevin had to leave, but I was at the meeting also.
Uh-huh. It's my understanding that many of those grazing allotments have been cut based on the discussion last night. And I believe that's what Troy just was referring to, is that there seems to be some differences in the federal agencies as to what the effects of the habitat improvements have been and how they're going to allocate any additional forage between wildlife and domestic animals. This discussion was about a two-hour-long discussion last night, and in the end, the RAC did vote 6-5 to support it. Obviously, with that kind of number, there was a fair amount of dissension.
Thank you.
I don't know. I guess it dies from lack of motion. Just like the board gets to.
Now we just won't do nothing.
I'll make a motion to approve the DWR as presented, the DWR proposal as presented.
Okay, we have a motion from Kevin to accept the elk management plan as presented by the division. Is there a second to that motion? Pam Riddle seconded. All in favor? Opposed? Passes 4-3.
I don't know that I've met most of you. I'm Makita Hansen. I work in the Habitat section for the Division of Wildlife and Price. I'm here to present two of our habitat management plans for two of our WMAs. The first one I'll talk about is Cold Springs. So if you don't know where Cold Springs is, it's that little red dot that's kind of between Price and East Carbon. If you go up East Carbon towards Bruin Point and the Tavaputs Plateau, it's up there. The WMA is about 2,675 acres. The average elevation is 8 to 10,000 feet. It is surrounded by private, state, and federal lands. The division doesn't own any of the minerals. The minerals underneath us are held by private, federal, and CITLA. The blue line on that map is the county road that goes through the WMA. It follows Flatiron Ridge and then goes down to Cottonwood Canyon. This road is open for public access, and then the other roads you can see in purple, those are only open for administrative access, and also Hunt Oil has an easement for utility and cattle trailing. In 2005, the division traded the Buckskin property for Cold Springs. The Buckskin property was originally purchased in 2001 during the Waldo Wilcox trade. In 2005, it was traded because of the better public access by road and by foot. We traded with TN Ranch. And then the conservation easement on that property was transferred to Cold Springs. Traditionally, the property had been used for summer livestock grazing and big game hunting, and before the property was traded, it was part of CWMU. And then those people in the bottom, you can't really see all of them, but those are everyone who was involved in the trade. So the purpose of the division ownership is it does provide outdoorsmen with access to over 2,500 acres of lands that were previously private. It also creates better access to some of the surrounding public lands in the area. It provides habitat for big game such as mule deer, elk, moose, and pronghorn, and also provides crucial nesting and brood rearing habitat for greater sage grouse, as I'm sure you all know are kind of on the ups and downs, so it's really important for greater sage grouse. Capital improvements. There are four roads. Like I said, only the one that goes down to Cottonwood has public access. There are fences on the property. Most are in a state of disrepair. There are two gates with barrier fences. Each of those are at two of the roads that only have administrative access to discourage people from using those. And then there are jack leg fences to discourage off-road driving. Then there was historical documentation of a cabin on the property, but it no longer exists. We do have livestock watering rights on seven springs and two creeks. The Cold Spring is protected by logs and pipes, and it's piped to a trough. And we do have one water catchment pond. As far as archaeology goes, there are several sites of historical interest, but none of that antiquity. Sorry. And the wood products, we have 751 acres of conifer and 945 acres of aspen, and that was determined by Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. These are just some of the wildlife that you can see on the property. So I'll let you look at those pictures. We have everything from big game to passerine birds to raptors to upland game to predators and bats. Adjacent land uses. The WMA is within the BLM's Nine Mile Canyon Wild Horse Management Area. This is important to note because horses in the area can cause resource damage, especially along springs. The Preston Nutter Ranch is adjacent to the WMA. It's about 25,000 acres, and it runs on the southern border for about 2 miles. There are radio towers at Bruin Point. Those could result in some increased traffic around the general area. There is oil and gas development. Like I said, we don't own any of the minerals on the property, so that could be an issue for us if someone decided to develop the minerals. Other activities include cattle grazing, hunting, and limited recreation. So some of our strategies for property management, there isn't a boundary fence on the property, and we do have an adjacent grazing allotment that runs from June 1st to October 31st. We've considered four options for a grazing plan: no action, a memorandum of understanding, to fence the entire WMA, and fence springs and water sources, and I'll discuss those further. The no action plan, if we go with this, cattle and horses will continue to have easy access to the WMA. Grazing overall in the WMA will probably be light, but there will be heavier use at springs by these livestock and horses. But the benefit of this is that there wouldn't be any fences to hinder sage grouse movement. Second option is a memorandum of understanding. It would define the number and kind of livestock to graze, the areas they could graze, and the season of use on the WMA with the adjacent permittee. This doesn't control any of our issues with wild horses, but it doesn't allow the DWR to award any grazing privileges or create revenue. Option three would be to fence the entire WMA. The boundary would be fenced with barbed wire letdown fence. It would allow the UDWR to control grazing. It would be really costly and high maintenance, and as you can see, there's a risk of sage grouse colliding with fences. Option four would be to fence springs and water sources. What we would use is pole or metal pipe to exclude the livestock and the horses, but still allow wildlife access. This would reduce resource damage near the springs. The cattle and horses could still graze the WMA and water at the nearby sources, but there is still a little potential for the fencing to create problems for sage grouse. Another option is we could implement different options within the plan. We could combine options two and four, which would be the memorandum of understanding and the fencing around springs. This would result in resource protection without the cost and maintenance of a boundary fence. Regardless of what option is chosen, we do need a comprehensive grazing management plan on the WMA. And just as a note, horse annual grazing is allowed on the WMA, but it's for day use and they have to be equestrian pack animals. So those can be on the property. Some of the property management development, we do probably need some signs that outline the basic rules. Each of these should probably be placed at the county road entrances. Public access, all vehicles have access on the county road and the 50-foot right-of-way. Existing roads, like I said earlier, are limited to administrative access or Hunwell. There is access by foot and horseback. Snowmobiles will be allowed on the WMA from November 15th to April 1st, but I do want to mention that if there is any resource damage occurring, that could change if there was a lot of damage and the division was seeing issues with that. It's closed to overnight camping, and there aren't any restroom facilities. This just kind of talks about the maintenance. Any fences we would do would be wildlife friendly and would be let down just due to the conditions up there. You can't really have a fence that stays up just from the snow. The main road would be maintained by Carbon County. We would maintain the side roads and Hunt Oil, if they needed to maintain anything, has the right to do that. We aren't planning any new roads on the property. Any signs would be placed by us. Any signs on the county road would not be our responsibility. They'd probably be the responsibility of the county. All water developments would be maintained by us, and noxious weeds on the county right-of-way will be the responsibility of the county, and then we'll take care of any weeds on our property. So, habitat improvement plan. Any improvements we have planned on the WMA will go through the Utah Partners for Conservation Districts and Habitat Council. They'll also be approved by Forestry Fire State Lands and the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. Forestry Fire and State Lands is who owns the conservation easement, if I remember right, so anything has to be approved for them. Any habitat projects in the future should be aimed at mule deer and sage grouse, but should consider all wildlife species. That map there shows the Cold Springs burn. That's actually, we're going to continue that on this spring. That's the project to reduce some of the conifer encroachment and encourage aspen regeneration. Other projects we could do would be conifer removal, sometimes sagebrush thinning to improve brood ring habitat, pinyon juniper removal, some limited alfalfa planting, different things like that. Fire management plan, it's a let burn policy on the WMA. The only reason we would ever suppress a fire is if there is a liability or an imminent danger. Timber stands are managed by Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. Management of the timber should favor regenerating aspen. We could do timber harvest for thick conifers, but there isn't any timber harvest planned right now. But if Carbon County decides they want to allow firewood gathering, that would have to be on the right-of-way. So in summary, the main function of Cold Springs is to protect wildlife species and their habitat. The WMA will be available for backcountry opportunities and day-use recreation. Camping, bicycling, and ATV use is prohibited except for on the county right-of-way. And then livestock grazing, logging, and prescribed fire are all acceptable management practices if they enhance the primary function of the WMA, and the habitat program manager and the habitat section is responsible for any monitoring. So if you have any questions, I can try and answer those.
Questions from the RAC.
So you need us to pass one of the options as far as the grazing plan goes? Is that what you're asking us to do tonight?
I don't think so. I think it's just we have those in our plan, so when we have issues in the future, we can select one of those options, because if we just put one, that would be what we had to use. So it leaves us options to manage our property differently.
Makita, it might be good to indicate, though, what we're leaning towards doing.
As far as I know, we're leaning towards the options 2 and 4?
Yeah, I saw Chris nod his head.
Okay, so options 2 and 4, to remind you, that was the memorandum of understanding with the adjacent permittee, as well as fencing off the springs to protect those from resource damage.
The adjacent permittee, he's okay with that?
Yeah, it's actually Blair Eastman, and we've met with him privately to discuss these different options, and he's agreed to what the plan says.
Okay.
Unless he's changed his mind and told you guys something.
He actually proposed fencing a lot of those springs.
I'm just wondering if I heard that right. So there, you can camp on the right of way, but there is no backcountry.
Correct.
Camping.
What do you mean you can camp on the right of way? I don't get that. You camp in the middle of the road, or?
Well, there's a 50-foot right of way on each side of the road, so.
So as long as you don't go past 50 feet off the road, you're okay.
As far as I understand. Is that correct?
So is it, but
never had anybody camp before, so
well, it just doesn't make any sense. You got no camping, no overnight camping, so.
Essentially, the right-of-way is owned by Carbon County. It's not a right-of-way. It's actually a deeded right-of-way. The Carbon County owns that 50-foot segment. So DWR has no say in what occurs on there.
But it wouldn't be a very nice place to camp.
Might be dusty.
Okay. So it's heavily traveled quite a bit? I mean, there's a lot of people in
there. Yeah, it's kind of a loop route for OHV. Trips to go down to 9 Mile and come back up Dry Canyon.
Okay.
Any other questions from the rec?
Are there a lot of wild horses?
There are. I don't have a population estimate. I know that the BLM wants around a population objective of 125 horses, but it's well above that from what I've been told and what I've seen. I don't know if anybody else has a better idea.
Brad probably has an idea.
I don't work for BLM, so I can't give population estimates. It's well over 200 on that ridge and 100 on the other ridge.
Wow. There's a lot. Huh. Easy to see.
Any other questions? Questions, audience? Comments from the audience?
That's a good idea.
Discussion motion from the RAC.
So we're just voting on the idea?
Yeah, we need clarification on exactly what we're voting.
Sure. My understanding is the management plan that was just presented, kind of the highlights of it, is a tool that the division uses to make decisions in management of their properties. And it's like all agencies that don't know what the questions are going to be in the future, try to keep it as broad and open as possible so that decisions don't have your hands tied. And I think that's what they're just asking us to approve, this management plan. And all decisions on that WMA will be have to adhere to the management plan.
It's general direction, but probably gives you a good sense of where we're headed.
Okay.
Okay, I'll make a motion to approve the plan as presented.
We have a motion from Pam to accept the Cold Springs, just Cold Springs WMA management plan. Do we have a second to that motion?
Second. I'll second.
Todd Huntington, second. All in favor? Unanimous. Lower Santa Fe.
I guess that got printed wrong because this is actually the upper San Rafael River. The lower San Rafael is closer to Hat Ranch. So this is located in Emory County. It's just southeast of Castledale. It's two separate properties, but part of the same WMA. So on the left is Hambrick Bottoms, and on the right is the upper San Rafael Fuller Bottom property. Together they make about 900 acres. They're both historic ranches, and as you can see, they kind of consist of little 40-acre parcels along the floodplain. Historic background, they're both named after their original owners, Tom Fuller and Thaddeus Hambrick. They had originally been irrigated and farmed for cattle forage. Floods of 1983, the floods destroyed the diversion dam, so that they stopped irrigating by flood irrigation, and then on Hambrick there is pump and sprinkler irrigation. It was originally purchased by Utah Power and Light in the early 1980s. They bought the property while they were building the Hunter Power Plant to retain the water rights. And then in 1982, they were conveyed an access easement to allow public access to the San Rafael River. In 1994, PacifiCorp, who was Utah Power and Light, donated the land to the Division of Wildlife Resources with the water rights and the grazing permits. This land donation was also part of the Lower San Rafael. And then during that exchange, the grazing permits from four BLM allotments were sold or traded, and then that money was put into an account for future property management. I just want to mention that none of the mineral rights were transferred with the grazing rights or water rights. So the purpose of the Division of Wildlife Ownership is there is fish, wildlife, recreation, and public access values. One of the most important things is that we can protect the water rights from forfeiture and abandonment with in-stream flow rights. This is really beneficial to some of the indigenous fish species of the San Rafael River, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Then other terrestrial species that occur on the WMA are mule deer, pronghorn antelope, peregrine falcon, and potentially desert bighorn sheep. They never have been on the WMA, but they are nearby. Some of the recreation opportunities are hunting, horseback riding, ATV riding. ATVs are restricted to one road that goes through Fuller Bottom. It dissects it, and it's maintained by the county. Everywhere else, it's forbidden. And then it's also on Fuller Bottom is the starting point for a 15-mile float trip on the San Rafael River. Like I said, Emory County maintains the road. There aren't any roads that access Hambrick Bottoms. There is a road on a map, but it's inaccessible by vehicles. You can get within a half mile, but it does cross private lands, and we're not really sure of the legal status of the road. But the historic use does suggest a prescriptive right-of-way. But, yeah, we would just have administrative access, mostly to Hambrick Bottoms. There are four winter-spring grazing allotments that border the WMA. Fuller Bottoms is mostly fenced. It's kind of in a state of disrepair, and then Hambrick Bottom doesn't have any fencing. And even though Emory County is a fencing county, we do have issues with livestock that come onto our property. I guess the reason Emory County is a fencing county is because they never really declared... They had never adopted a fencing ordinance. So what fencing basically means is that you're required as a livestock owner to make sure your cattle or livestock stay in your property. But if people don't have fences and we don't have fences, we really have no way of controlling that. We do lease 14 animal unit months at Hambrick Bottoms for winter grazing from December 1st to March 1st. And we have installed a cattle guard on the north boundary of Fuller Bottom. So that's just a picture of the grazing allotments that surround the WMA. We do have two water rights for Hambrick Bottoms, and we do have two water rights for Fuller Bottom. We have those water rights in an in-stream flow right now, but we do have an option to put them back into irrigation if we want. On Hambrick Bottoms, we could irrigate about 120 acres, and on Fuller Bottoms, we could irrigate about 180. cultural resources. The Spanish Trail crossed or was very near to what land is now part of the WMA. Hambrick Bottoms may contain a gravesite, but there's a possibility that the gravesite actually is on BLM. It's not really known for sure. There is remains of an old log cabin on Hambrick Bottom, and then the old diversion at Fuller Bottom that was washed out in the flood. Three fish species. The federally listed Colorado pike minnow, razorback sucker, and bony-tailed chub. We don't really know their historical importance in the area. It's likely that they're not there now because of large diversions that have created barriers to their migration, but they may have used this area for spawning in the past. But what this area is really important for is the three state-sensitive species, which are the flannel-mouth sucker, the bluehead sucker, and the round-tailed chub. They are among the greatest conservation need in the state because of their declining numbers. And Fuller Bottom actually has some of the most complex fish habitat and best populations in the state. And what's nice about this area is that diversion structures lower actually keep some of the non-native fish like carp and catfish out, and so they aren't able to compete with these other fish, so it actually helps them maintain their population. So the water rights are really important in this area to keep the stream flowing and promoting habitat for these fish. So that's the flannel mouth. That's the bluehead. And that's the round tail. That's about the extent of my PowerPoint skills right there. The five important habitats are lowland riparian, wet meadow, high desert scrub, lodic water, and cliff. The ones with asterisk biome are just high priority habitats, so those are on the WMA. And obviously, desert streams provide valuable habitat for wildlife, terrestrial, amphibious, and aquatic. Then there is potential habitat for the following species: yellow-billed cuckoo, southwestern willow flycatcher, Mexican spotted owl, peregrine falcon, northern river otter, reptiles, amphibians, bats. And I don't remember if we've actually had any of those on the WMA, but there is potential habitat for those species, so it's important that we maintain habitat there. There are some limitations. Spring flows are often diverted to reservoirs for late season irrigation. This kind of changed the way streams have worked historically, because streams that used to dry up are now perennial, and then a lot of times there's wastewater that's in the streams, which is basically water that had been used for irrigation and is now back in the streams, and that's usually got a lot of salt and high mineral contents in it. These altered flows can affect fish habitat a lot. And then also another thing that we don't know if it's going to change the stream flow is there's a lot of conversion now from flood irrigation to sprinkler irrigation and pumped irrigation, so we don't really know how that's going to affect the fish and those spring flows. And then also monsoonal moisture floods the dry washes and perennial streams. And then terrestrial, livestock grazing on the riparian grasses and sedges may affect wildlife. The problem here is that, like I showed you earlier, where it's just 40-acre parcels, it's really hard to fence, so it's really going to be hard to keep livestock out. And then some of the habitat threats to the property are development, drought, energy development, fire cycle alteration, improper grazing practices, improper OHV use, invasive animal species, invasive plant species, nutrient enrichment, and water development. And what I wanted to point out, it's not really as big as an issue anymore. The Electric Lake zebra mussels, and I think it was 2008, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, they found DNA of a mussel, but since then the detected status has been removed. But if they are ever to get in our waters, you can see the bottom of that boat, that happens fairly quickly, and it can clog a lot of springs and really alter water flow. And then also the mussels threaten habitat because they filter out all the stuff that fish need to survive. Development activities. We don't really have much planned for development. There are some signs that are probably needed. The BLM does have a recreation sign in station, mostly for people who are floating the river. And
I thought you were going to say mostly to shoot at.
Yeah, you can see that sign's been shot up pretty well.
Very good grouping, so.
Like I said already, fencing's difficult and not really cost-effective because of the way the property is. habitat management, we could seek opportunities to buy any surrounding lands if it ever does become available. Tamarisk defoliation with leaf beetle. Tamarisk is an issue on a lot of river corridors. And any efforts to remove tamarisk and should be sought by us. And then other projects we could do, steam bake stabilization and erosion control. But all of our future projects will mostly target native fish, turkey, pronghorn, mule deer, and upland game. Access management, like I said, OHV, ATV, and bicycle traffic is all restricted to the main road that goes through Fuller Bottom. There is that vehicular administrative access that goes through private property on Hambrick Bottom, but the legal access really isn't known. All other traffic is permitted. That includes on foot, horseback, canoeing. Primitive camping is allowed, but there aren't any additional roads planned in the future. Fire management, prescribed fire for tamarisk removal is an option we want to keep open. Tamarisk wildfires are a real threat, and all the salt grass in the understory could really carry a fire. The reason it's such a big deal is it takes out all the cottonwoods that are really beneficial to wildlife. And then campfires are allowed on the WMA, but wood from live cottonwood trees can't be used, and the fires must be contained in a fire ring. Wood products, all the cottonwood should be preserved for wildlife and aesthetic value. Driftwood can be used for firewood and can't be transported off-site. And tamarisk wood products can be harvested in the future if there ever is a market to arise. The grazing plan, there isn't a formal grazing plan. What I'm talking about here with the AUMs at the current 34 acres per AUM, that is what we're using with the 14 AUMs we have on Hambrick Bottom. That wouldn't really be an acceptable use for the entire WMA, so that would have to be considered. We would need to get a fence inventory and determine how much fencing we would need in maintenance. But any grazing we'd have would have to be prescriptive. And there wouldn't be any goats, sheep, llamas, or camels allowed just because of the close proximity to desert bighorn sheep and the potential for the spread of disease. So in summary, our primary function is to protect and preserve habitat. The Division of Wildlife is obligated to safeguard the in-stream water rights. We're also obligated to maintain river access. ATV and OHV use is denied off the county-maintained road. Livestock grazing and prescribed fire are acceptable for management, and any monitoring will be done by the habitat section. Any questions?
How are you on your water rights? How are you maintaining your water rights if you're just letting it flow down the stream? Does the state let you do that?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Sorry. Those water rights are a unique water right within the state of Utah, and that state engineer has granted us the right to use that water for irrigation, or it can be left in the stream as in-stream flow. Utah Division of Wildlife Resources is one of only two agencies that can hold an in-stream flow right. So that's what that primary purpose of the water is in that throughout the San Rafael properties, is we leave the water in there for fish habitat.
Charlie, just a side note to that, though. In order to, you know, to make the in-stream flow, the state engineer required us to relinquish our priority. It went from a senior water right to the junior water right on the system. So, you know, we basically have whatever's left in the system after everybody else
is done with it. And do you get very much after that?
Depends on the year.
Right.
You know, but it does go dry down below
sure.
Highway 24. Or whatever it is, it goes to Hanksville.
Any other questions from the RAC? Any questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Do we have an audience?
Rick, come over there.
Discussion and motion.
This looks like a huge headache. Why did we take this on? I mean, was it just nobody else wanted it, or?
That, but it was also a large chunk on the San Rafael River, going east from the ranch area. So there was a large chunk there that probably what was wanted, but these came with it.
basically the biggest benefit we get is the ability to manage water for the, you know, the state sensitive species in the river. And that's okay. Kind of where our management is focused. Down at Frenchman's on the Hat Ranch, we've, you know, taken out a lot of the tamarisk and we've reestablished the river into its historic channel, and we're looking at working with Hats to change the diversion, maybe go to pump irrigation or something like that in the future. And so basically what we're trying to do is manage the riverine system to the benefit of many wildlife species.
When that property was obtained by the division, it came with big BLM allotments, and they were given back to livestock people, sold back to livestock people, essentially.
Right.
So it kept the grazing on the Santa Fe Desert.
Okay.
Motion?
I'll make a motion that we accept it as... I'm sorry, Kevin.
No, you're fine. I'll second it here.
Motion is made by Charlie to accept the management plan on the Upper Santa Fe WMA, seconded by Kevin Albrecht. All in favor? Unanimous. Chris. Well, Chris is coming up on the elk management plan. I told you at the beginning on descending boats. If any of the three of you would like to make a statement into the record, you're free to do so. So, as far as why you voted against the elk management plan.
Good evening. My name is Chris Wood. I'm the Habitat Program Manager for the Southeastern Region. Presenting with me today is Nicole Nielsen. She's our Energy Habitat Biologist. I just passed out this spreadsheet. The spreadsheet kind of gives you an idea of the last 3 years, what we've done as a habitat section, working with our partners to do habitat restoration work in our region. The first page is a list of the projects that we did last year. The second page is a list of the projects that we're currently involved with. And then the third page is projects that are on the list to do next year. And so on this first page also is my name and contact number and info, and Nicole Nielsen's name and contact info, and then Daniel Eddington, who is not here today. He's our habitat restoration biologist. So the purpose of that was we want to work with the public and with our partners, with our RAC and our board members. If you ever have habitat restoration ideas, feel free to give give us a call. We'll meet you out in the field. We'll try to develop a project with you. And we have Daniel Eddington's our restoration biologist that works with our public partners, the Forest Service, the BLM. We also have a biologist that solely works on private lands and uses the NRCS. And then Nicole Nielsen works with energy companies to do habitat restoration work. And so we're really involved and familiar with all the different grants out there. And depending on the landowner and the objectives of the project, we can find funding for these projects. So this first slide, I'm going to talk for a little bit about the overview of the habitat work that we've been doing for the past few years and show you some pictures of some tools that we've been using. And then Nicole is going to discuss some specific projects that we have done in the last year or two and a few that are planned for the future. Oh, this first slide shows the number of acres that we've done since 2005. As you can see, we've done almost 67,000 acres. And that's just in the southeastern region. This is going on statewide. You can take that number and easily multiply it by five, probably even bigger than that, because there's five regions. So, and I divide it up by mule deer units just because people are interested in mule deer and what we're doing in mule deer areas. This is not to say that all those 67,000 acres are specifically for mule deer. But I would guess that 90% plus of those acres that have done have a mule deer benefit. You might ask, why is the South Book Cliffs only 2,000 acres? Most of the work that's been on the Book Cliffs has been done in the Northeast region in the summer habitat. That number will increase over the next few years as we implement a Bitter Creek project with the BLM. And let me also first point out, too, my next slide kind of alludes to this, that when I say we, I'm not necessarily talking about Division of Wildlife. I'm talking about us and our partners. We have so many great partners, and there's so many funding sources out there that we collaborate with to implement these projects. We have what's called the Utah's Watershed Restoration Initiative, and that's a state money from the legislature that they give us each year. We take that state legislator money from the legislature, and we match it with federal monies. A lot of times we work with the BLM and the Forest Service with their fuel crews and their fuel projects. BLM and Forest Service have a lot of money to do fuel reduction projects. And as a wildlife agency, we can team up with them, with some of these sportsmen groups as well, and we can make what is normally just a fuels project, both a fuels project and a wildlife project. And so that partnership's been going on since 2005 and before then, and it's really grown and become a great, great resource for us. You can also see some energy companies up there, ConocoPhillips, Bill Barrett, Anadarko. A lot of these companies are developing for natural gas. Realize that there are impacts that come with their development. And they can come to the table and say, hey, we're going to develop 50 wells in this area, and we realize there's going to be some impacts because it's on winter range. But with that, we have some money to put back on the land and try to improve and reduce our impact. And so that's where Nicole Nielsen comes in. Her job is to specifically work with those companies and use that money and team it up with all these other partners to make a really good wildlife project. Let's see here. I also should mention another partner I don't have on here is Habitat Council. So Habitat Council is a group that meets together once a month in Salt Lake. There's citizen members and division members on this Habitat Council, and they take money that comes from sportsman permits, and a percentage of that goes back on the land. And so Habitat Council is also a great partner. So just to show you some slides of the techniques that we use the last few years, all of these slides I've been showing you all have like 10 pictures, I think, up here. They've all been of projects that have been done in the last year or two in our region. This is the Cold Spring Fire. It happened 2 years ago. We had a very narrow burn window. We weren't able to burn the 1,000-plus acres that we wanted to because of the narrow burn window. Last year, unfortunately, the fire crew got up on the mountain, and that evening it poured several inches of rain, and the fire was postponed for the year. We're hoping to continue the cold spring burn the second week of June. And so here we're burning conifer trees to promote aspen habitat. This is our funnest, latest, newest, greatest toy that we have. It's called the chain harrow. It mimics a chain, but doesn't get the criticism and the scrutiny that perhaps a chaining project does. We use this chain harrow to do a lot of things, but one, you know, to improve winter ranges throughout throughout the state. I believe this might have been on the Henry Mountains. In a lot of areas, we have pinyon and juniper trees encroaching onto sagebrush benches, our winter ranges for mule deer and elk. A lot of times those benches have a really good understory, but if we don't take care of the pinyon and juniper problems, the junipers will choke out the grasses and forbs and sagebrush and other shrubs that are so valuable. And so for a relatively little amount of money, we can hire a chainsaw crew, and they'll come in and chop down these pinyon and juniper trees, cut up the branches, and then scatter them on the range. We also do a lot of water projects. We have over 115 guzzlers in our region. We team up with the BLM and the Forest Service to maintain, fix, and put in new guzzlers. This specific project was on the Henry Mountains on Tarantula Mesa. It was a pretty complex water project where we had a well and a pipeline, and with the well and the pipeline, we were able to put up drinkers throughout the mesa and distribute the bison and the cows a little better.
This is well fed by well, or?
Correct. Okay. This is another tool that we just created. We take, you know, an old army dozer and modify it to create a habitat tool. And so on the front of that dozer is a scalper, and this project is actually up on Porphyry Bench, where Cliff Rose is a really species of choice, an ice cream plant, if you will, for a mule deer. And so we picked out an area where there was cliff rose in the area, and we used this scalper to plant more cliff rose. We use airplanes both for seeding, as you'll see in the next picture, but this picture is actually their spraying plateau. Plateau is a chemical that we use to suppressed cheatgrass. So in a lot of areas where there used to be sagebrush, their fire came through and nothing came back but cheatgrass. The cheatgrass is the first grass to green up in the spring. And so by using this chemical and early seeding it, we're able to suppress cheatgrass growth, seed some sagebrush and other grasses and forbs in there, and allow other things to compete with it. This, I think, project is with the BLM up at Bitterbrush, or Bitter Creek, in the South Bookless. And then most of our projects, well, projects where there needs to be, the understory needs to be enhanced, we use contractors to aerially seed projects. And so a lot of times we'll fill the plane up with grass and forb seed. We'll fly it on, and then they'll use a chain harrow or a harrow or a chain or a bull hog or whatever the mechanism is to reduce the juniper trees or to turn the dirt over. And then once we put down the grasses and forbs and disturb the land, we'll come up with another flight full of sagebrush seed. And then we do a lot of drill seeding, too. This is another picture after they sprayed plateau and burned some of the areas. We drill seeded out at Bitter Creek in the South Book Cliffs Unit. We're enhancing mule deer ranges and elk ranges both summer and winter, but we're also looking out for all species that we're guardians over. So this is the Matheson Wetland in Moab. This is a prescribed wetland burn. We're enhancing habitat for waterfowl, for migrating birds, and I think there's over 200 species of birds in that wetland. So we're enhancing habitat for game and non-game species. This is a picture of the lower San Rafael Wildlife Management Area. This project was removing tamaricks, the Hat Ranch area. Removed several thousand acres of tamaricks, and then with the record floods last year, by removing the tamaricks trees, the stream banks were pretty unstable, and it created some really cool backwaters and enhanced the native fish habitat there. So there's several sensitive fish that live in that stretch of the river, and by removing tamaricks, we're enhancing their habitat. I should also say that after the tamaricks is removed, we've gotten in there with several thousand trees and planted native cottonwoods and willows. And we have volunteer planting days. This is on the Matheson Preserve. This is a harrow, I believe. We're in areas where the sagebrush is too thick and there's not a good understory. We'll use a harrow and we'll try to get some better understory. This is out at Gordon Creek at our higher elevation, Bob Wright area. And then this is a picture of a bobcat with a fecon head. Its larger brother is called a bullhog, but the point is that this fecon head at the end of a tractor or a cat or a bobcat in this case, that fecon head mulches up those trees and reduces the pinyon and juniper trees so the understory can be more productive. And the mulch lays on the ground and acts as a really good cover and maintains soil, and the response a few years after a project like this is incredible. And with that, I'll turn the time over to Nicole, and she'll discuss specific projects.
We just wanted to highlight a few of the projects we've done in the last several years. First one I wanted to discuss was the Hiawatha Miller Creek Bullhog Project. This project is near the old mine town of Hiawatha. You can see some before and after pictures. Before, it was a thick pinyon juniper with hardly any understory. The after picture is just the year after. I mean, we did that in the fall of 2010. By the summer of 2011, you already have stuff coming back in. It was aerially seeded, and then a bullhog was used to treat that. That's 290 acres. We partnered with sportsman groups and ConocoPhillips to fund this through UPCD, the Watershed Restoration Initiative. There was just multiple partners in this project. Grimes Wash was a chaining that was done this last fall. It was also thick pinyon juniper with no understory. It was aerially seeded with a helicopter, and then chained after, well, we chained it one way, airily seated, and then chained back the other way. Sometimes the roots of the trees will stick in the ground and you don't get a complete kill, so you have to bring them the opposite direction to bring the roots completely out, and that allows for a kill on the trees. Grimes Wash is near the old Wilberg mine near Orangeville, so mule deer winter range. This was 275 acres. We partnered with XTO, Sportsman Groups, Watershed Restoration Initiative. Just really neat project. Spirit of Conservation is a grant that is done through the Fish and Wildlife Foundation along with ConocoPhillips to enhance bird habitat. This is actually this benefits multiple species, raptors, migratory birds, big game. This area is in between Price and Huntington on the benches near Moreland. There's still a pretty good understory, so we just had a chainsaw crew come in, cut the trees down, cut them into smaller pieces, and hopefully allow the sagebrush to grow, and so that they don't have to compete for resources. That project is halfway complete. This was done about a month ago, and 1,000 acres of it has been completed. Total, there will be 2,000 acres. And this is also, with the grant along with state monies as well. Shea Mesa was, it was done a few years ago. This one is kind of a neat project in conjunction with Colorado State. Is it Colorado State or the University of Colorado? They're doing research on the amount of erosion from these projects. So this project has a bull hog, pile and burn, just kind of lop trees, and then a broadcast burn. There's also an exclosure that was created so that you can see, which methods you get more erosion, less erosion, and this will help in the litigation process that sometimes happens when working on federal lands. There's a lot of concern over erosion, so the studies, looking at the different methods, and right now it's looking like bull hog is the least erosive. That project's about 1,300 acres. It was funded through WRI, Sportsman Groups, state monies, and the BLM. Black Ridge is another pinyon juniper winter range project. As you can see, the before pictures, hardly any understory. The pinyon juniper trees had encroached in the area. You can see right afterwards, you're getting some growth back. You're creating more groceries for the animals. That project's 1,500 acres, and it was a bull hog as well. Some of the projects that are up and coming is Beef Basin. This area was once a sagebrush winter range. It's converted to a grassland, a lot of cheat grass. So this project is going to be implemented by the BLM, about 2,200 acres. There will be a lot of methods used. They'll use plateau to spray on the cheatgrass. They'll use a rangeland drill. They'll drill seed some seed. They'll, in pinyon juniper areas, that they'll pile and burn. There will be some fencing to fence livestock out. So this is one of the up-and-coming projects. The Nashwash WMA, we have some upcoming projects this year as well. There's an old chaining that the conifers or the pinyon juniper are encroaching back into. There'll be a lop and scatter in there to try and, well, not to try to remove the trees. And in some of the fields where we don't have enough water to irrigate anymore, we'll do kind of a rangeland mix for deer and upland game, turkeys and whatnot. And some ponds will also be cleaned out for bat habitat. And finally, I'd like to invite the RAC members to our UPCD field tour. Here at the end of the month, we'll be going on the Henry Mountains to look at some projects that have been done out there. And in July, we'll be going to Cold Springs and hopefully seeing the burn. Hopefully it gets lit off. And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Nicole.
Meeting, if you're interested in going to Henry Mountain Field Tour, we're meeting at, May 22nd at 8 o'clock in Hanks, 8:30 at the BLM office in Hanksville.
This is an action item.
It's not. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a lot of action.
It is. Last agenda item is Farron Creek introduction.
I'm Justin Hart. I'm the aquatics manager in the Price office. For the last 9 years, I've been the sport fish and native cutthroat fisheries biologist, and I just recently replaced Paul Bergey, who's now our cold water coordinator. The primary reason we're here is to get RAC support for the Colorado River cutthroat trout reintroduction and restoration in the Farron Creek drainage. Anytime we reintroduce a state conservation or sensitive species, the process involves getting local support, local city, county support, submitting the project through the RDCC process, getting RAC approval, and ultimately approval from the Wildlife Board. So I've got a presentation that kind of gives an overview of the project, some of the things we've done to date, and some of the things we have planned for the future. First off, probably most of you are aware where the Farron Creek drainage is. The drainages that are highlighted are pretty much the only areas we have in our region where we have native cutthroat suitable habitat and records of historical presence. So the San Rafael drainage there is where Farron Creek is located, up towards the top. Here's kind of a rough view of the drainage. Millsite Reservoir, just near the town of Farron, is at the bottom. And we have a lot of interconnected tributaries that ultimately make it their way up to Duck Fork and Farron Reservoir, which are both about 50-acre reservoirs at the top of the drainage. So we have a lot of stream miles there. Here's kind of a satellite imagery. The grayed out area kind of encompasses the Farron Creek drainage. A lot of those tributaries towards the bottom end there are kind of ephemeral and probably not suitable for cutthroat habitat, but it kind of gives you an idea the scope and the connectivity we have in this drainage, which is one of the reasons it's so attractive. What we've done so far is a couple years ago, when I first started in 2002 and 2003, we were working on Duck Fork Reservoir. We rotenoned that reservoir, removed all the fish, and we transplanted some pure Colorado River cutthroat trout from the White River drainage. It's taken several years for us to get to the point where that brood lake is finally developing. The initial fish we stocked were immature, so it took 3-4 years before those fish matured and we were able to get eggs. Since then, we're increasingly producing up there, so we're ready to move on and start doing some real on the ground work. This drainage is the most attractive we really have in southeast Utah in the Colorado River cutthroat areas. We really only have two drainages in our region that have the amount of interconnectivity and aren't diverted and cut up into pieces: the Farron Creek drainage and then Muddy Creek drainage, kind of next door. Those two are the biggest ones we have, and these big projects are, I think, in our opinion, more valuable for conservation efforts than, small little piece projects just dealing with a few miles. Like I mentioned, Duck Fork. Finally, in 2009 was the first time we collected any eggs, and in 2009 and 10 we collected about 70,000 eggs. Those are spawned on-site and taken to our Fountain Green Hatchery, where they're hatched and ultimately stocked out. Over the last several years, we've supplemented the Duck Fork population with these fish. We started with just 800 fish in Duck Fork in 2004. The last several years, we've stocked several thousand back in. So I think probably this year we're going to pick up some mature males, probably not females yet, but here in the next couple of years, I think the duckport population is going to be extremely robust, and we're going to have a lot of eggs in production, and we need places to put them. We've also stocked some of those fish into Millsite Reservoir strictly for sport fishery reasons, not necessarily for conservation. And then where these fish came from, I mentioned a bit ago, was White River. We've been able to supplement that population, Right Fork, Middle Fork, and Left Fork. There's quite an extensive amount of habitat there. It suffered some really serious drought issues in 2003, 2004 when I first got here. So we're able to supplement that population, which has really helped it. There's about 47 stream miles that are suitable for trout habitat in the Farron Creek drainage, which is a tremendous number when you consider a project of this nature. There's also a number of lakes up there. Some of them, Duck Fork in particular, is a conservation population for cutthroat. The rest of the lakes up there are going to be sport fisheries. We don't have any plans to create conservation populations, so they'll stay sport fisheries like they currently are. We also have a different type of native fish tie here. Of course, the Colorado River cutthroat trout is a native fish, the only native trout to this part of the state. But we also have bluehead suckers, which are present in Millsite Reservoir and also the bottom end of Farron Creek. So this makes this drainage extremely attractive for a project of this nature, just because of the two different native fish we have and the potential there to work on both those species. Several years ago, 2007, Willow Lake and Wrigley Springs are popular sport fisheries up at the top of this drainage. We switched from stocking a diploid rainbow trout, which is a rainbow trout capable of reproduction, to a triploid, which is a sterile fish. The reason we did this is both those reservoirs really have no suitable habitat for rainbow trout to reproduce, so they don't successfully maintain themselves in the reservoir. However, when those fish escape and get down into the creeks below, they're perfectly capable of reproduction, and they will actually hybridize with cutthroat trout. So we switched to a triploid fish several years ago because by the time we likely get to the point we're moving down drainage and reclaiming the streams, those fish that are capable of reproduction will no longer be there. They'll have died of old age. So we won't have to treat these reservoirs and make them unavailable to anglers, which is a positive. Last fall, we built a fish barrier. This is the overflow dike in the middle of Farron Reservoir. When the lake spills, water runs through here. It's directly connected to the creek below, so it was important for us to create a barrier at that point to stop fish from downstream moving up into Farron Reservoir. So, and I'll mention, we treated Farron Reservoir last fall, and this will ensure that fish from below that are non-native cutthroat, rainbow trout, potentially some brook trout, are unable to make it back into the reservoir. And then I mentioned our duckport production already. In 2010, we set up a planning team for this project. We had representation, of course, the division. We had Forest Service representation, the Conservation District down there, and some water users. We've realized since that future meetings, we need to include some more sportsman representation and some cattlemen. What we did with that team is we tried to identify potential issues that we thought we would get when we presented this project to the public, to the anglers, and other stakeholders in the area. Of course, we talked about water use issues that might come up, loss of recreation potentially. A big one that we came up with but really turned out to be a larger point than we thought was the creation of a cutthroat monoculture. You know, when we talk about doing a project like this, a lot of people assume that we're just going to have nothing but a super restrictive cutthroat fishery with special regulations. And that's not the case here, and I can explain that a little bit later. And then grazing issues, you know, all of those were obvious, and we tried to come up with answers and ways to work around those and meet those people's concerns. We presented this to the Public Lands Council 2 years ago, and it went over very well. The council, I think, supported this very strongly and made a motion to support the project. I was invited back the next meeting for some further discussion, and some of the people, primarily irrigators and cattlemen, felt like we didn't do a good enough job, you know, selling this project, getting information out to them. So we had a public meeting in Farron. Kevin was there. I thought we had a pretty good turnout. Paul spent some time talking about the Endangered Species Act and how that all works, and then I gave a pretty detailed presentation on what this project is, what our goals are, what this means to the people, and we had some really valuable discussion there, and I think it was very positive. After that, we went back to the Lands Council meeting. Some of those same people came and voiced their support after we had a chance to talk and address some of the issues that we missed the first time. This last spring, we went and formally presented this to the Emory County Commission, and they supported it and appreciated all our efforts, and we appreciated theirs too. That Lands Council was a great venue for us to get feedback from the public and discuss issues like this. We also met with San Pete County. The extreme upper end of the Farron Creek drainage is in San Pete. So I can't remember the exact name. It was a recreation committee or something with San Pete County. Their issues were a little different. They were primarily concerned about loss of angling opportunity with rotenone treatments. You know, anytime we do one of those, there's a temporary loss of opportunity. And they also had issues with, you know, how we were going to change traditional family fisheries and issues with and concerns about, you know, restrictive regulations and things of that nature. So once we talked to them and explained what we were after, they supported the project as well. Last fall in September, we did a rotenone treatment on Farron Reservoir. We have another one planned as early as we can this year, which is going to be pretty early. Farron Reservoir is about 50 acres. We were able to draw the reservoir down as low as we could get it, turn the dam outlet off so there was no water escaping to treat the reservoir. And there's only about 2 miles of tributary above Farron Reservoir. It's a pretty small watershed. Farron Reservoir contained rainbow trout capable of reproduction of diploid. Some non-native cutthroat trout primarily had Yellowstone trout genes in them, and then brook trout. So it was important for us to get rid of those fish, which the rainbows and the cutthroat are able to hybridize with natives degrade their genetic integrity, which is basically the main issue we have. And brook trout, of course, are competitors. Here's kind of an overview of the lake. The red are the tributaries. A lot of those just pop up out of the ground. A lot of that water just comes right out of the hill. Really low flow streams. All those dots are where we had a drip station where we drip rotenone into those tributaries to treat them. Once you get bushwhacking in there, it was kind of amazing where water would just appear out of nowhere. So we had about a dozen drip stations for treating the tributaries. Like I mentioned, a lot of these streams were really, really low velocities. So we only used about 5 gallons of rotenone total. And the way we do it, we have a 5-gallon container that has water in it. We add rotenone. And in the case of this project, most of these 5-gallon containers only contain 4 8-ounces of rotenone. And that slowly drips into the stream for about 6 hours. The concentration, of course, is based on stream flows and how fast our drip bucket drips, and our target concentration is 1 part per million of rotenone. You do that for 6 hours, and that takes care of it. So, not a lot of rotenone is needed. Here's a picture of the reservoir. Kind of the white coloration coming out of the back of the boat is the powdered rotenone we used to treat the reservoir after we drew it down. The way we applied it, it's really slick. It beats the way I've done it in the past. That's a water pump right there on the back of the boat, and basically water is sucked in on that side, spit out the other, and there's another line that connects in the middle, and with the water passing through, it creates a vacuum, kind of like a super powerful shop vac. So we're able to just stick that into a big, about a 50-kilo drum of powdered rotenone, and it just spits it right into the prop wash out the other side. It's really clean, really effective. You don't get a lot of drift. Really easy way to apply it, and the treatment took no time at all. We put about 520 pounds of powdered rotenone into the lake. It only took about an hour to drive around, spread that out over the whole water body. It eventually mixes with wind and waves. And like I mentioned, we're going to treat again this June. Pretty much standard operating procedure for us is to do a rotenone treatment and then repeat it a short time later. That just ensures we get, you know, as complete a removal of the target fish we're after as possible. And very shortly after we do that, hopefully here in the next month, we're going to be able to restock it with catchable-sized triploid rainbow trout and some Colorado River cutthroat trout, the natives that Fountain Green has overwintered for us. And those fish will probably be between 7 and 9 inches. So we'll have it fishable hopefully by July 4th this year. That's our goal. So the two little pink circles, the top one's Duck Fork, which we've treated and have natives in. Farron is going to be done now, and that leaves all the rest. Some of you that are familiar with this area know how remote it is in there. So we have some challenges and some decisions to make on how we're going to proceed from here. I think we've decided to probably treat it in some sections. Trying to do that all at once would be an extremely ambitious project. It'd be expensive, logistically difficult to do. So I think we're going to treat it in smaller sections. We'll have to, of course, work closely with the Forest Service. We'll probably have to put in some temporary fish barriers, treat above that to the barrier, and then no non-native fish from below can get up. We'll move downstream and then eventually remove those temporary barriers and have a whole connected population. The other issue we're currently working on is the bluehead suckers I mentioned in Millsite. Bluehead sucker, of course, is also a state conservation-sensitive species. We're trying to get a firm understanding of how much those suckers use the lower end of Farron Creek. At some point, we'll probably need to put a large barrier in on Farron Creek itself because we really don't want to have to rotenone Farron Reservoir. Millsite, of course, is quite a bit larger. It's locally popular as a sport fishery, and we'd rather not, you know, treat that. So we're going to have to put a barrier above Millsite at some point in time to keep fish in Millsite from moving back up into the rest of the drainage. So we're trying to identify where that needs to be so we're not creating, you know, reduced habitat for the suckers. And then also logistically, where is that even possible to do, because the remoteness of some of that is a challenge. So basically, you know, we'd like RAC support for the reintroduction of this project. We feel it's a great project. You know, a project of this size with the amount of tributaries we have creates a really stable population. It's not susceptible to a localized fire, you know, a landslide, something of that nature. And in the big scheme of things, trying to restore this species as a whole, this type of project creates, you know, some really, really powerful ammunition for the next time somebody petitions us for listing. You know, this type of project is exactly what we need to be doing. And I think everybody, I think, sees that value in this. And, of course, you know, my main job is, of course, conserving this species, but also creating sport fishing opportunities. We're removing fish, we're removing rainbow trout, we're removing cutthroat trout, we're removing brook trout, but we can come right back in with sterile alternatives to each one of those species and our native cutthroat and create diversity sport fishing opportunities. We're not just going to have cutthroat trout in there. We're able to provide a wide-ranging range of opportunities for our anglers. That of course, is a major goal here, too. Here's a picture of some cutthroat we spawn at Duck Fork. If any of you are interested, we usually do this usually mid-June to July 1st. It's really cool to see our hatchery guys come down and help us with this process. You know, we've normally been spawning a couple dozen fish a day. That may increase this year, but if any of you are interested, get with us. We'd love to have you come out. It's pretty neat to see it. That's it. Do we have any questions?
Any questions from the RAC? Questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Motion? Discussion, motion.
I'll make one comment. I do know that this has been a tremendous amount of work by the division and a lot of public scoping and getting comments. And the one comment I would make is I do realize that there's going to be a little bit of time that anglers may be inconvenienced. But I support Justin in the fact that in the long term, we're really going to be able to say what a great Colorado cutthroat fishery that we have for just a little bit of time of inconvenience. And I think that just as we've done, say, as with the sage grouse, I think that it's a great project, and you guys have done a good job. Thank you.
Are there active petitions out there to continue to try to list Colorado cutthroat?
But, you know, they pop up occasionally.
The last petition there is still wending its way back through the report. The Fish and Wildlife Service came back and said it wasn't warranted. The petitioners waited approximately a year and then took it back to federal court, and it's in the hands of, you know,
some wise justice.
Yeah, and who knows where that's going to wind up. We honestly believe that it's only through projects like this that it won't be listed.
Okay. We ready for a motion?
I'll make a motion that will support this program.
Okay, we have a motion from Charlie to support the reintroduction of Colorado River Cutthroat into Farron Creek. Seconded by Pam. All in favor? Unanimous. And I think that concludes this short agenda we had tonight.